ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Bite Night Picks with your host, Frank and Matt Allen.
Just like that, we're back and we're set for UFC Fight Night, Rodriguez versus Lemos. Really looking forward to an all-action type of card that's not totally dependent on the main event, but in this main event, Rodriguez and Lemos, you have a couple of fighters who have a wicked combined record of 28-3-3, vying for an opportunity at that straw weight title, aspires to take on Zhang Wei Li in the near future. And of course, you had Mackenzie Dern in a tricky fight against Yan Xiaonan in a main event not that long ago. But if we do focus on this entire card, thanks so much for joining in. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, respective socials, Matt Allen FNP. Last weekend was a dud.
It was
this
tough.
Weekend. I mean, listen, Neil Magny's taking on Daniel Rodriguez in the co-main event. We've got plenty of prospects to look forward to. One lone UFC debut for Brazil's Tamiris Vidal. But overall, Matt, one of those cards that I think a lot of people can rally around. And if they thought that last weekend was a bit of a stick in the mud, this is one that can kind of pull you right out of that hole, that quicksand.
I feel like we were robbed of a great main event last weekend based on the knee injury that Calvin Kattar did sustain. Now, it is unfortunate. You never want a fight to end that way. Very reminiscent of Tom Aspinall, Curtis Blaydes, of course. That's the last time it really comes to mind where a fight was ended very early due to an injury that was really starting to shape up to be an interesting matchup. But that's the thing. Were our records great last weekend for the predictions? No. And even if Arnold Allen was going to win by TKO, let's say, anyways, because let's be honest,
Arnold was looking pretty good in that.
Exactly. Arnold Allen was looking really good, and I think that just plays into what we were both saying before that fight happened. It was, hey, we don't really care about who wins and who loses. It would just be nice to see Arnold Allen prove himself to be on that level. And even out of the short sample size that we saw, I feel like it had proved that, hey, he should be fighting more guys in that top 7 kind of category. I know it's weird to cut it off at number 7 in the division, but you get the idea. Anybody in the top 4 could fight for a title, so anybody after that kind of immediate top 4, I think Arnold Allen is deserving of an opponent of that level, but I hope you agree with me when I say this. I was really excited because it felt like about a month ago, stretching into the last pay-per-view we had, the bantamweight division was very active. I really enjoy it when we have one division getting a lot of 5-round fights, a lot of activity, a lot of just press exposure, and it feels like the women's strawweight division right now is experiencing that. Like you had mentioned, we are just coming off that main event between Mackenzie Dern and Yan Xiaonan. Maybe not the most exciting fight of all time, a competitive fight, a fun fight, but still, I think the winner of this fight probably is a little bit more to acclaim if they are able to look really impressive to a title shot. But I gotta be honest, I'm really excited for this main event. I think both fighters' styles really play into each other, and I think we're going to get a fun striking matchup.
Should be a great one. Listen, it's 13 fights total. We do have one that's been rescheduled and thrown onto this card. Miranda Maverick taking on Shanna Young. That co-main event, Neil Magny, Daniel Rodriguez, was originally booked for last month, but unfortunately an elbow infection to Daniel Rodriguez sidelined the matchup for about a month. We're going to throw it on over to our fight of the night screen. We really like to hear from you, hear those comments, see which fight you guys are going with, kind of leading the charge in that respect. And listen, there's 13 of them. You're not wrong till Saturday night. Let us know who you have in the fight of the night screen.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you've got. It's time for the fight of the night with Fight Night Picks.
In a fight that would have been the cat's rear end about 3 years ago, we have the return of Oroville, California's own Benito Lopez, a guy who's just 3-1 in the UFC, was taking on a good level of competition, then dropped off the face of the earth.
It's
he's
going to
be taking on Mario Bautista, a guy who's, I mean, he's like Hansel. He's so hot right now. And for Bautista, seems like an odd fight to take. And I've seen some of his interviews out there getting ready for this matchup saying that if he wins this fight, he wants a ranked opponent next. It might be a weird one, but if you just boil it down style for style, both guys like flying knees, both guys like combinations right down the pipe. tape, and they'll mix in their own wrestling in different respects. So I think this is going to be an absolutely amazing fight in a absolutely loaded bantamweight division.
I couldn't agree more. And that's the thing about Mario Bautista. You might look at this fight and immediately think, well, wow, Bautista's a lot higher up in the division. We might be talking about two unranked fighters, but you get the idea. Just he's closer to the top 15. But the weird thing about Bautista is he will fight to the level of his competition. And that's why I think this is going to be such an exciting fight. Bautista has great power, but sometimes he will pursue offense at the detriment of his own defense. So I think this is going to be an incredibly exciting fight at 135. And I do agree with you. I think for Bautista, he is in that weird limbo in the division where he's proven that he is very talented, but he's got some bizarre losses if you look at his record. So I think for Bautista, if he is able to look really impressive in this matchup, maybe do a great job on the mic immediately after, I think he could propel himself into that top 15 category.
Great opportunity for both these guys. Benito Lopez steps right back into a good opportunity. We have a look at our second pick, and you might go, what? Like, Craig, are you trying to throw one over at us like Zubera Tukugov and Lucas Almeida? Listen, it's unfortunate that fight didn't get to happen. We were robbed of a potential fight of the night from a few weeks ago. But you look at Grant Dawson, training out of American Top Team, makes the switch after having that poor third round against Ricky Glenn. It's a draw on Dawson's record, but he goes out there, fights Jared Gordon, finishes him in the third round. He's going to be taking on the Olympian Mark Madsen, 2016 silver medalist in Greco-Roman wrestling. You know the drill. But for Madsen, this is third camp straight out of Fight Ready in Arizona. He's looked much improved in the striking his last two times out there. Bit of a controversial win over Clay Guida. Not necessarily as controversial over Vince Pichel's last time out. But Grant Dawson, not known as a striker. So I do expect if we get into some of those wrestling exchanges that you will get a lot of action in the scrambles. This could be a very, very fun fight in the lightweight division.
For Mark Madsen, I didn't think you could teach an old dog new tricks because he did come into the UFC very late into life. We talk about his wrestling background. He is an Olympian, of course. He is one of the better pure wrestlers to ever transition into the UFC. But the thing about Madsen is, I didn't know if he could make those improvements as he progressed through his career, but you mentioned it. His striking has improved drastically, I would say, since he has entered the UFC. He just seems a lot more confident of himself and his own gas tank. But I think this is a very unique matchup for Mark Madsen because you look at his last matchup against a guy like Clay Guida, someone who is a good wrestler, he's been around for a long time. He is more of a vet at this stage of his career, so you can beat him on your best day. You might lose to him on your worst day. Grant Dawson, okay, he might not be that really hyped up prospect that he once was in his career, but we understand how good he is on the mat and how competitive he is with his own grappling. So I'll be very interested to see how Mark Madsen looks if maybe Grant Dawson gets his own takedown. Maybe he's able to get a sweep or something. I think this is a very fun fight. Normally we pick these fight of the night since, hey, these are two great kickboxers. They're going to throw down and just throw bombs. This is kind of the opposite of that, but I still think this is going to be an incredible fight.
Everybody's excited about Neil Magny, Dana Rodriguez. I'm sure we'll hear from you down below. Neil Magny's last bonus was when he got the win and the comeback against Hector Lombard. So good opportunity for both of those guys. Some very exciting fights on this card. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have in the fight of the night screen. So we have a look at this 13 fight set. Only four ranked fighters on the card. Marina Rodriguez, Amanda Lemos, you have Neil Magny and Daniel Rodriguez in the welterweight division. You might be down on that, and you could be. I could understand it, but when you have 13 fights, when you have some nice rookies, you have that return after 3 years away from Benito Lopez. He was a fighter that we used to talk about a lot on the channel. We did kind of a recap of the first few seasons of Contender Series before we even got into our Contender Series breakdowns. Benito Lopez, somebody that, you know, a lot of people are very, very excited about. Had that nice win over Albert Morales. Had that weird loss that was really quick. You know, took the O against the Bermudez Triangle, Manny Bermudez. And then he obviously had that went over Vince Morales before he went away. But you do look at this card, and we have the return of one Jake Hadley, the return of Carlos Candelario, both looking for their first UFC wins, the return of Ludwig Cholignon, who didn't really have a good showing his first time out, but also fought Jack Shore in a short notice debut.
I don't know about you, but at least to me, I remember a lot of these prospects that the UFC has really tried to heavily build over the past few years. And for a fighter like Miranda Maverick, who now is kind of buried on the prelims, you can't forget 18 months ago, 2 years even, she was one of the UFC's kind of golden childs, if you will, and she really was pushed heavily by them. I know she has had losses recently, and again, she is on the prelim of a fight night, so it is easy to overlook her matchup against Shayna Young, but still, she's a fighter who, at least originally, the UFC did promote quite heavily, so it's always interesting to see those fighters kind of continue their career after they're no longer promoted by the organization. So for Maverick, a great opportunity to kind of become the fighter she once was again, and there's always fighters like that on every card, even for a guy like Neil Magny. Like, Neil Magny's had so many ups and downs. I know he's in the co-main event against Daniel Rodriguez. This is a very hyped up fight, but still, for Magny, this is a really important one, because you don't know how many more chances you're going to get against top 15 opponents before the UFC just sort of feeds you to these up-and-coming prospects, and you just sort of become that gatekeeper outside the top 15. So I really do think for Neil Magny, he has a lot to fight for in this matchup against Daniel Rodriguez, but we all know how dangerous Rodriguez is, so that co-main event, I think, is a very exciting fight.
Rodriguez coming off a very controversial split decision win over one Li Jingliang back a couple of pay-per-views ago. And for Neil Magny, not so controversial, he lost to Shavkat Rakhmonov impressively. We have a lot of big-time fights. Make sure, if you're not subscribed, to subscribe for more of the action. Kicks is going to be live 2 hours before the prelims on Saturday. And if you toss us a like, we would certainly appreciate it as well. Matt, we have a lot of fights to talk about. We're going to throw it on over there. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Bantamweight division needs a refresh, and long ago are the days of Ronda Rousey and Amanda Nunes just completely reigning over this division. Well, for Amanda Nunes, she is, but the point is, we need some new, fresh talent. And coming up this weekend, we have Hong Kong's Rona Pascual looking to win that first time in the UFC's octagon. 0-2 so far to start her UFC career. This is her fourth fight in 2022. She's going to be taking on the debuting Brazilian fighter that is Tamiris Vidal. The nickname is Tratora. And we've had a lot of Trators, but not a lot of Tratoras.
We have not.
Chief among them, probably Michelle Prezeris. And I don't know what that guy's on, but for Tamiris Vidal, hopefully she's not on that special sauce. But when it does come down to this matchup, Matt, we look at the division, we consider the fighters that are ranked at bantamweight. There's only about 8, if you go into the UFC fan rankings, that are outside of those 15. So if you win here, maybe another win, you have a number next to your name. So a good opportunity for both of these women coming into this matchup.
And if I may, it is kind of odd, isn't it? The bantamweight division is the oldest women's division, so you would kind of expect that to be the deepest and the most exciting. But right now, when you look at all the women's divisions, I would almost argue the opposite.
No, like, featherweight's right now, the worst, man.
Oh, well, okay. Featherweight has... there's more people in this room right now than there are in the featherweight division. But you would agree with me, though, it is kind of wild. Like, flyweight, yes, the champion's very dominant, but there's a lot of great fighters in that division. Strawweight right now, I would argue the top 6 feel like they're elite and that they're all very competitive. The bantamweight division, just for being around as long as it has been, like you mentioned, since Ronda Rousey came over from Strikeforce, it is kind of wild that it has kind of stalled out the past few years.
Well, you do consider this fight, and I mean, it is a weird one. So if we do consider it for Tamiris Vidal, she comes out of Team Brothers Niteroi. And I mean, listen, you can see her from the picture, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu brown belt. She's competed in many, many tournaments. It is her specialty. And if you go down, you look at her overall career arc, that is for Vidal, she's fought a varying level of competition. I think that's a decent way to put it. There definitely are names that you do recognize. I mean, she was 1-0 taking on 9-3 Carol Hosa, who is ranked in this division at number 9
right
now.
Pretty tough fight.
In the UFC, she loses that fight by submission. That was the main event of MMA Brutus number 1 in 2019. So Vidal continues throughout her career. And did I recognize Vidal from that fight? No, I didn't. I thought, geez, I feel like I know this name. I feel like I watched her fight and watching tape here in the last couple of months. That's because a couple of fights ago, you had Tamiris Vidal taking on Eileen Perez at Samurai Fight House number 2. And I showed you a picture of that fight on the screen when we were breaking down Perez versus Egger, because they fought on like the gym mats that I have in my basement. And in that fight, Perez beat her pillar to post. And then she landed a couple of illegal knees in the third round and lost because of those illegal knees. So out of that, Vidal becomes a Samurai Fight House bantamweight champ. She takes on Kalia Braga over with LFA. I thought it was Quilia the way it was spelt. They pronounced it a completely different way. But in that matchup, it was a boxing of Braga, who actually has a true pro boxing fight coming up in the near future. The boxing of Braga, some of the kicks to Vidal, who obviously has the jiu-jitsu, and you know her for that. She won that fight by heel hook. But if you do watch the nuts and bolts game of Tamiris Vidal, I know the record's decent. She also has a win over Martina Jindrova, who's somebody who fought Kayla Harrison. Main event at a PFL playoff card in 2022 did Martina Jindrova as a plus 1,500 underdog.
And not a great look.
I'm going to let you guess. Did she beat Kayla Harrison? The answer is no. Vidal looked halfway decent in that fight, but my point is, Vidal 6-1, Pasquale 6-4. I'm surprised Vidal's in the UFC right now because her game is incredibly basic at this point.
But, and hopefully you will be, or hopefully you will agree with me when I do say this, I did expect more out of Ramona Pasquale when she came into the UFC, and I don't want that to completely cloud my judgment, because when you watched her outside, she just seemed to have a lot more power. There was a lot more, I guess, just aggression behind her style, if that's fair.
Well, there's two parts to it, too, so if we kind of sway away from Vidal for a second and talk about Pasquale, you look at her win over Shamir Peshewa that she had with Invicta. That was a fight that came in on incredibly short notice. Pasquale was due Courtney King, and on what, less than a week's notice, Pasquale steps in, catchweight 150. And that's the other thing about Ramona Pasquale, this is her first fight at bantamweight in a number of years.
She's not young in her career by any means.
No, she isn't. And originally her fight against Josiane Nunes, that one was at 145 pounds. The fight that she had against Jocelyn Edwards was supposed to be at 135, and then it seemed like out of the Edwards camp they wanted it at 45 and ended up at 45. And if you do consider, you talk about the aggression that Pasquale had, she's 6-1 in Muay Thai, you know, transitioning into MMA. She was part of the UFC PI in Shanghai. She had a lot of really good fights and also was a member of the Hong Kong women's national rugby team. But if you look at it, the tie clinch and the knees are the biggest part of her game. You saw that in her fight against Jocelyn Edwards her last time out. Seemed like she was going to finish her in the first round, and then the air kind of got let out of the tires around two rounds.
And that's the weird thing about this fight. I think the clinch is where Pasquale can have a lot of success with her own offense, especially with her striking, like you would mention. Her knees are devastating in that clinch, going to either the head or the body. She does have a very strong clinch. She is a very physically strong fighter, and I am very curious to see what she looks like on the scales on Friday, because like we had said, her first time down at 135, not a young fighter by any means in her career. I think she's 34, so again, not the oldest fighter, but still, it's just surprising age to decide to move down. But like we kind of joked about in the opening, there's not a lot going on at 145 right now, so your opportunities are somewhat limited. So maybe if Pasquale is able to move down to 135, look very physically strong, and really implement some of the offense we were able to see before she came over to the UFC, I could see her having a lot of success. But my issue is, especially with her game plan, if she does try to go for the clinch a lot in this fight against Vidal, is that not going to invite the takedown? Is that not just going to make her job that much easier? Because I think if Pasquale is on her back, we all know who has the advantage in an opportunity like that. I think for Pasquale, she definitely has an area that she can have a ton of success in. I just worry that that one area also puts her in a lot of danger.
And both of these women could kind of quote-unquote weight bully a lot of the fighters in this division. If you do consider it for the fighter in Vidal, she's 4-0 at featherweight in her career. She's 2-1 at bantamweight, and even one of those wins, the one over Eileen Perez, that one was by a disqualification. She was handily losing that fight. If you go and watch it, if you look at it for Ramona Pasquale, she's had 5 fights at featherweight. She's 2-3. She's had 2 catchweight. She's 2-1. And she's 2-0 at bantamweight. But the competition she had faced at bantamweight in her career, one was a debuting fighter and one was 4-5. So neither one of these women out of their wins, other than Vidal beating Martina Jindrova and having that win over, of course, Eileen Perez by disqualification, has fought the highest level competition. But for Tamaris Vidal, what I've seen out of her with her takedown attempts, especially in her last fight where she gets the heel hook, her opponent goes for a judo throw in one of the opportunities. And then out of that, Vidal just kind of pushes her way into a takedown. The second time, it's more or less the same thing. So it's out of her opponent's mistakes where Vidal is able to get the takedowns. There's other fights, the Jindrova fight, chief among them, where Jindrova's taking her down. For large portions of the fight, Vidal's just pressing the action up against the fence, where a lot of UFC referees might be giving them the old action. I need to see some action. So Vidal, I'm not overly impressed with her. And the reason being is, when she's standing up, she kind of stands like an old-timey boxer. She's a little bit squared up, and all she has is a clubbing right hand.
There's a lot behind it, be fair.
She throws a big-time overhand right. For Ramona Pasquale, she will mix it up a little bit. She will throw some more kicks, but by and large, for Pasquale, her volume numbers have been very low in the UFC, and if you just look at it from a numeric perspective on UFC stats, 3.83 strikes landed per minute to 8.73 absorbed. The Edwards fight, round two, round three. Nunes was dropping her six ways to Sunday.
It's not like Pascual's fought like a crazy high level of competition in the UFC either. I do feel like that has to be said. It's not like this is a fighter who came in on short notice to fight like Valentina Shevchenko. Kind of like Priscilla Cachoeira. Because I feel like for Priscilla, again, she's not the greatest fighter in the world by any means. But like, by this point, she's kind of got her respect. A good power puncher. She's not some scrub in the UFC. But if you just look at her raw numbers, they're heavily skewed because of that one performance. But in her defense, she fought the greatest women's fighter, arguably, of all time. For Pascual, that's not the case. It's not like she came in and started fighting ranked fighters immediately. So that's what does trouble me, because I did think she was going to be a fighter who'd come in, really implement her Muay Thai, and have a lot of success from the get-go. And I don't know if I'm just so down on her right now. That's why I kind of agree with where the odds are. Or if I should just give my head a shake and just say, hey, Pascual's fought the higher level of competition. She's not going to have those octagon jitters, because she has been there at least. And that's the one thing you can point to. Some fighters do get nervous in their UFC debut. I'm not saying it's everybody, but it definitely does happen. So I just think this is a really difficult fight to predict, because A, both fighters have obvious ways where they're going to have a lot of success, and B, I was left wanting a lot more from Pascual, so I don't really know where I rate her right now in her career.
And we'll see how it goes. 8 days notice for Pascual taking on Josiane Nunes, and in an interview that she had done with the All-Star MMA and JHK, friend of the show, the headline was Ramona Pascual reveals lessons learned in Singapore, prepared to point fight if needed. That's exactly what I love to read. The odds in this matchup, Pascual opened the underdog plus 200. She's a plus 130 right now. Vidal open minus 235, minus 160. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise us, they are to you. It's a tough fight to try and go with. I'm going to say over under 70% Vidal.
I'll say under.
You're going to say under? It's over. 542 total votes, 85% Vidal, 77% by decision for the 15% that have Pascual, 74% by decision. I have no idea who's going to win this fight.
Thank you so much.
In their next fight, they're not going to fight anybody with a number next to their name. So that leaves you a pool of six other fighters. Chelsea Chandler is probably the next opponent for the winner of this matchup. But if I'm trying to make a pick here, both like the clinch, Vidal for the takedown, Pascual for her own shots and her knees. I have a hard time. I really do. I'd like to say Pascual, because the takedown defense, the level of training partner she has at Syndicate MMA, and the limited striking I've seen from Vidal. But if Vidal is able to hold it up against the cage for long periods of time, cage control wins fights for some people. So there's an opportunity for Vidal there as well.
Remember when Jelton Almeida came to the UFC and how excited we both were for his debut? There were obvious skills, obvious areas where he excelled at, and obviously he had a very high ceiling as well. We don't really have that same excitement for Vidal. And I think that is fair because, again, it's a fighter who is a very good grappler. She is good off her back, too. I think she will be active if the fight does end up going where Pascual initiates a takedown, because I could see maybe Pascual not going for traditional takedowns as such, but you get the idea. There is going to be a good amount of clinch in this fight. There's going to be a scramble. At some point, one fighter's going to end up on top, one's going to end up on the bottom. If Vidal ends up on top, then okay, maybe there is the opportunity for her to secure a submission, but I do think that even if Pascual ends up on top, I think Vidal is active enough on bottom to at least threaten to get back up to her feet, and that's what I do like. So I do agree with you. I would like to pick Pascual because I do think she's steadier on the feet, even though, again, you point out some of her volume numbers and they are not good whatsoever. But I will pick the UFC debutante in Vidal. I do like her grappling a little bit more. And I do, again, think if Pascual is going to have a lot of success, it will be very clinch heavy. And I think that if it does end up in the clinch, it at least gives Vidal the opportunity to get some of those trip takedowns.
The longest, most in-depth video you're going to watch.
I'm so sorry, guys.
On Tamiris Vidal taking on Ramona Pascual. It rhymes. I'm going with Hong Kong's Pascual, Matt going with Brazil's Vidal. We have some big time fights on this card, including Magny versus Rodriguez and Rodriguez versus Lemos up at the top. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Flyweights looking to buck their first UFC loss in their first UFC fight. We have the former EFC and Cage Warriors flyweight champ, Jake Hadley, the nickname White Kong, change it, taking on
Carlos the Cannon Candelario. It's a little bit better, but coming up in this matchup right here, you look at their records, 8-1, 8-2. Decent level of competition for both guys. For Candelario, came in on Dana White's Contender Series a few years ago. Back in 2017, it was the first season. He picks up a win there against one Arnaldo Candido. And after winning that fight, he took a really long time off. He had multiple issues with his knees. He gets a win over Miguel Restrepo. And then he ends up on Contender Series again. He takes on Victor Altamirano. Wins round one. Loses round two. Loses round three. Loses split decision, but Dana White said, hey, I thought he won the fight. We're signing the guy.
It was a good fight.
It was the first fighter to lose on Contender Series was Carlos Candelario to get an opportunity into the UFC. They fed him to the wolves in his first fight against Tatsuro Taida.
Oh, no.
It did not go all that well for Candelario. He had to defend the takedowns. He wasn't able to implement his own offensive wrestling game, which is pretty well a hallmark. Candelario's ground and pound is a giant, giant statement of his game as well. So for Candelario, struggled to find the range, struggled with his own striking in that fight. And now he's looking to pick up the pieces against a stylistic equal in Jake Hadley, a guy who's very good at his offensive wrestling. You consider the level of competition that he fought. Bellator, Blaine O'Driscoll. Taking on good guys over the Cage Warriors. You know, beating Luke Shanks definitely means something. The win that he had against Mitch Raposo over on Contender Series, he finishes him. That was one where people love Mitch Raposo. New England stand up. I mean, Carlos Candelario knows Mitch Raposo very, very well. But for Hadley, he gets that win by submission. Comes into the UFC against Alon Nascimento as more than a 2-1 favorite in the matchup. And couldn't really do a whole heck of a lot. There was a big size difference. Like, Alon Nascimento, you see him down at Shoot the Box, yeah. Diego Lima, training with Charles Oliveira, with, Thomas Almeida. And Nascimento looks as big, if not bigger, than those guys. So you could see that big size difference in the cage when Hadley was taking on Nascimento. But even when Hadley would get the takedown on Nascimento, and Nascimento would end up on bottom, he'd threaten with a submission to then reverse position, and Hadley really didn't have any opportunities in that fight whatsoever.
And that's why it is interesting when you look at the last time Candelario was in the UFC octagon. He fought Taeda, who, again, is one of the best prospects in the division. I think that's fair to say. He has more than proven that. And his offensive wrestling is legit. Like, don't take my word for it. Go back and watch his previous two fights. He is, again, like I said, he's a future top 15 guy, and he's going to be around for a really long time in the division. But for Candelario, he wasn't able to get much off of his back in that matchup. But the question is raised, is Jake Hadley going to be as controlling, I guess, in the top position as Tetsuro was able to be? Because, again, we point to one of the best prospects in the division. Then you look at Jake Hadley, a guy who can kind of stall out in some positions. And again, I know we always talk about the odds later on in the video, but just bring them up really quick because you had mentioned it. Hadley was a big favorite his first time out in the UFC. And normally when someone is a big favorite in their UFC debut and they look really underwhelming, they're not really given the benefit of the doubt by the odds makers the next time out. And that's why I am interested to see him as a 2 to almost 3 to 1 favorite in a lot of the odds books. So again, I don't really care what your overall opinion is of either fighter or what their ceiling is, but I don't really think there's a massive separation between one of these guys, and that's why I'm very interested to see what the odds where they are.
Again, for Hadley, higher level competition, former champion, a couple of different organizations, open minus 250, minus 277. For Candelario, open plus 210, plus 222. And I mean, just numbers on a page. Candelario's lost 2 in a row. Hadley obviously losing just his last fight.
To a good fighter.
Candelario started off his pro and amateur career combined 13-0. And if you do look through it, I mean, decent offensive wrestling, good combinations to close the distance. Candelario is normally the guy that's crushing that distance between the two fighters. He's able to win out with a nice 1-2, the power with the volume. Then he takes the fight down to the mat. Once he softens you up on the feet, he's able to implement that ground and pound. For Jake Hadley, it very much is the wrestling. And if you go back to his title fight that he got against Luke Shanks, he gets wobbled by the first combination that Shanks throws. And then it's just takedown city for Hadley to the point where there was a judge that had it 50-42 in that matchup for Hadley winning in a big-time title fight. So you know that the cardio can be there. Now, Hadley missed weight on his Contender Series fight against Raposo. Dana White took a bullet for the kid because, they didn't want me to sign him. I'm signing him. He's the bad boy of the UFC. And Hadley's had a lot of matchups that have fallen out so far in a short UFC stint. So it'll be interesting to see what we do get out of him. But when you do look at it, I mean, great offensive wrestling, trains out of a great team in Birmingham. Obviously, Dominique Wooding just left Cage Warriors, ended up in the PFL. You got Sam Creasy, Von Lee,
I mean, everybody remembers Von Lee, right? Like, he fought TJ Dillashaw.
He did
way
fight
back
TJ
when.
Dillashaw.
So, for Jake Hadley, we'll see if he's able to kind of meet fire with fire and if he's able to win out here. Because the odds, I don't necessarily love them. And when we're trying to kind of project a ceiling for the prospect, I know I like Jake Hadley, but I didn't kind of see him as high as maybe you did at one point.
I was really excited about him. That is what I wanted to bring up. I was really excited to see him fight Nascimento. I thought that was going to be a good fight, and it was. And again, that's what I do want to bring up. Losing to Alon Nascimento doesn't mean you're some scrub. Like, what?
Tagir Ulanbekov almost did. I thought he did.
You know what I mean, though? Like, again, that's a good fighter to lose to, and I do think that is an opportunity for you to learn. I just don't like where the odds are in this matchup. Again, I like Jake Hadley's engine, and I know that's a weird thing to kind of point to in this matchup, but I do think that if both these guys are involved in a lot of grappling-heavy exchanges, we see a lot of wrestling back and forth, a lot of scrambles. Well, that definitely plays into Jake Hadley's game plan over time. I do like his gas tank, and I like how he does scramble, and I like how he grapples. He grapples almost like a volume striker would strike, and he gives you a lot to think about when he is able to secure that offensive takedown. So, for those reasons, I do like Jake Hadley in this matchup, but I guess since I was so high on him coming into the UFC, I just want to see a nice, solid performance from minute 1 to minute 15. I don't even want to finish, you know what I mean? It's one of those fights where if he wins in 40 seconds, he's going to teach me less than he would if he wins a unanimous decision where he looks really good. So I'm excited for the fight. I think both guys have a big opportunity in this matchup, but I do like Jake Hadley.
You hear that, ladies? He doesn't even want to finish. He's just there for you. We there have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise to us as they are to you. And I'm assuming that the fans are kind of thinking along your train of thought. The younger fighter, former 2 promotional champion, Jake Hadley. I'm going to say over under. I'm going to go 82.5%.
I think it's going to be over. I think it'll be in the 90s.
It's going to be high, and it is. So 537 total votes, 93% Hadley, 50% by decision, 40% by submission. For the 7% that have Candelario, 64% by decision. And for me, it's more the fact that I've seen Candelario slow down in some of these fights. The Altamirano fight, the fight against Taeda. When he's finishing them, he's getting it done very, very quickly. And I don't necessarily see Hadley as one of those guys that's going to get in a terribly compromising position all that early. And I think the fact that you can see some switch stances and southpaw looks from both of these guys, that opens up the threat of the body kick. And I think that actually helps Hadley a little bit more than it does Candelario. So for those reasons, I like Hadley in the matchup. But as Matt said, you know, you're going with a minus 275, minus 280 guy at this point. I don't necessarily see the value. I have to see some UFC wins first.
100%. I couldn't agree more. I like Hadley in the matchup, but it's one of those fights where it's okay. You win this, then we reassess what your ceiling is. Maybe you could get not a borderline top 15 fighter, but again, there's not a ton of fighters in the division. So at some point you're going to get one of those like top 25, top 20 guys. Because again, there's not that many. So I do like Hadley in the matchup, and I agree where the splits are on Tapology. I agree with decision, but I could see a world where Candelario does get exhausted from a lot of the wrestling, and Hadley could win by submission later on if Candelario isn't really watching himself with the submission defense because fatigue has set in.
Both of us going with White Kong to get the win. Coming up this weekend, you have a big time card. I'm really looking forward to Mario Bautista taking on Benito Lopez, and that's coming up very soon. You're not going to want to miss it, so keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Bantamweights in search of a big-time win. Coming up this weekend, we have Topology's 96th-ranked Bantamweight taking on the number 105 man. It's Johnny Munoz Jr., Kid Kvenbo taking on Ludwig Chalignan, and I can't really pronounce his nickname, and I do pride myself on pronunciation, so Palmeiros. And if you do consider it for Chalignan, he came into the UFC off of the Ultimate Fighter. He was one of the favorites to win the season. He ends up losing to eventual champion Ricky Tercios. Tercios actually threw volume that landed in that fight and outlanded Ludwig Chalignan. So they bring in Chalignan, just, you know, they kind of keep him in waiting, keep him in flux, and he ends up in on short notice taking on Jack Shore.
Tough guy to fight on short notice.
Hard to look all that good in that matchup. So if we do switch gears and we focus on Kid Kvenbo, I mean, listen, the guy's a grappler. The nickname, it was his dad's nickname. His dad's name,
Johnny Munoz. Like, even in the movie The Big Lebowski, they called him the dude. So he didn't get confused with anybody else. But, of course, the Nihilists and everybody else, they confused him with Jeffrey Lebowski. And then all of a sudden, you got a guy peeing on your rug. And you're listening to...
I've never watched the movie.
You've never watched that movie?
Ever.
You've never lived. But the point of the matter is, you pick a nickname to, you know, completely differentiate yourself from anybody that has the same name. But he has his dad's nickname. He has his dad's name. You think that they exchange shirts, too?
That'd be weird if they did.
It would be, but his dad and his family did give him his black belt. And Johnny Munoz Jr. is a very, very accredited jiu-jitsu player. No-gi champion. He's an SJIF champ in 2016. Former King of the Cage bantamweight champion as well for Johnny Munoz Jr. And he was undefeated before he came into the UFC. He took on a tricky, tricky guy, Nate Maness. A lot of people thought that Munoz had won that fight against Maness. It was his takedowns versus the limited striking that we saw out of Maness in that one. Maness also on this card. Munoz goes out and fights Jamie Simmons. And you think, hey, Jamie Simmons is a good wrestler. He's going to take him down. Munoz landed some of the worst volume I've ever seen in my life.
It was bad.
Like, none of those punches hit his face. And if you want the exact number, Johnny Munoz landed 11 of 56 significant strikes in the first round of that fight.
This is my problem with Johnny Munoz Jr. He's like a straight-A student who can't stop fucking up outside of school. Like, I don't know what movie it's from, but have you ever seen that clip where Morgan Freeman's like, "You're smoking crack, aren't you?" And he's like, got tears in his eyes and he's crying. And that kid's like, "Yeah, I've been smoking crack." That's what I look at when I look at Johnny Munoz Jr.
You're watching those movies, but not The Big Lebowski?
Hear me out. Johnny Munoz has all the tools. He's like that kid from the rich part of town. You think he's doing well in school, he's good at sports, but you're like, damn, he got arrested? Like, really? That's the rumor around school. Because Johnny Munoz has all the skills. You bring it up. He is great on the mat with his jiu-jitsu. He has good striking. In theory, but the thing is about Munoz, it is one of those, I'll believe it once you show it to me. And to be fair, we said the same thing about Trayshawn Gord leading up to last weekend's card. And hey, I've been wrong before and I'll be wrong again in the future. Gord was able to prove to us that he does have the potential. Maybe not the highest potential in the world, but there's still a good MMA fighter hidden in there somewhere. For Johnny Munoz Jr., I hate to always bring up Gilbert Burns, but he is one of the most obvious examples of, hey, you're a good striker, you're a good wrestler, you're a great grappler. Why the heck can't you put it all together? For Munoz, he has always left you wanting more, and that's the problem. When you're 1-2 in the UFC, it's not a great look. And then when you look at his one win, you're right, Jamie Simmons, in theory, is supposed to be a good wrestler. But there's a lot of other fighters out there that if we didn't give them the benefit of the doubt of a guy like Johnny Munoz, who, again, has all the tools, we'd look at that 1-2 with the one, let's just be honest, somewhat suspect win over a guy who isn't the highest caliber in the world, and we would not look at Kid Kvenbo and be like, hey, this is a guy who has a high ceiling. But I'll sit here right now and say, I do think Johnny Munoz is one of those guys, like a pitcher who's in AAA until they're 30, and then they do that one kind of minor technical adjustment, and then they're able to make it to the big leagues. I really do feel like once Johnny Munoz Jr. is able to get over whatever mental hurdle he has to put his whole game plan together, I still think there is a good fighter there.
I don't even think there's a mental hurdle. The fight against Nate Maness, he replaced Ray Borg on a couple of days' notice.
That's true.
He beat Nate Maness. He goes in and takes on Jamie Simmons. Simmons is a good wrestler, wrestled in college. Munoz goes in. They're not double legs. It's just he wraps his hands as he's running the pipe around, like, above his waist. Got both of his takedowns, got one at the end of the first round, gets it at the second round, gets into the rear naked choke, and it's easy, it's done. And then he's taking on a guy in Tony Gravely, and he's doing well. I mean, as short as it was, he gets pushed up against the cage, goes deep down for the double leg, and as he does, Gravely lands an uppercut. They meet both ways, and Munoz ends up getting finished. And I thought Munoz is going to have a lot more success in that matchup, considering how good Gravely is as a wrestler, how good at jiu-jitsu Munoz is. That was going to be a fun fight. Well, if you expected a lot out of that, and you expected a lot out of Jamie Simmons, we throw it on back to Ludwig Shalinian, the second part of this fight, because he was on the Ukrainian national wrestling team, and that's exactly where his base is found. And if you consider it for Shalinian, he fought a really good level of competition coming up through, and we know him for that loss to Ricky Tercios, who ended up winning the season. He fights Mitch Raposo on The Ultimate Fighter. Going back and watching that fight today, it was a little weird because Raposo won the first round and you just had Shalinian kind of chasing him and not really landing much. And then in the second round, he works his takedown. So then they have a sudden death. Third round,
and Chalignon's able to take him down a little bit more. It was a close third round. I thought it could have gone either way, but Chalignon gets the win there. Has a win over Yuma Horiuchi that was a really good one in 2019, and also had the fight in Bellator 209 against a former CFFC champ, Sidmar Anadio, and also a split decision win over Vince Cachero for what it's worth. Cachero ended up in the UFC. So you look at it for Chalignon, takes that fight against Jack Shore on short notice. He was replacing Zviad Lazarsvili on a couple of weeks' notice. Loses that one 3x30-27 on the judges' scorecards. He was booked against Nathaniel Wood back earlier on this year, which feels like an odd one because Wood's very good at
featherweight. I think it's fair to say that would have been a tough fight for him.
Shore and Wood.
Nathaniel Wood's pretty good.
But you look at this matchup, Matt, I think both guys can kind of meet in the center because for Chalignon, he does a really good job of trying to cut the cage. Oh, wait, no, he doesn't. He kind of chases opponents, has good takedowns, but doesn't really do much with them once he gets in top position. So it is an interesting matchup, all things considered. But I don't know. I mean, he's got a pretty damn good Instagram game. He's got like 22,000 followers, so that's kind of good. Trains with some really good fighters, in the Vegas area, if you do consider it that way, too. I have a little bit of a hard time here, but Chalignon, for being a prospect, for being 9-2-1 at 32 years of age, you know, it is a tricky one for him taking on Johnny Munoz Jr. because Chalignon, by and large, low volume when it comes to his striking. Johnny Munoz, crank that volume button, pull it right out, but he doesn't even have the accuracy of like a Caitlin Chookagian in some of these fights.
The weird thing about this fight, though, is I think Munoz has the advantage in pure grappling. We all know how good his submissions are, especially if he gets in the top position. He might have the advantage on the feet, but Chalignon is the better wrestler. Like, he has the ability to pick what poison he wants to go after, so maybe Chalignon in that top position can have some success. Again, it's tough to be a good grappler off your back. You can be Fabricio Verdum, you can be Brian Ortega, you can be Charles Oliveira. It's tough to get submissions at the UFC level off of your back against really good MMA fighters who have the benefit of being able to strike you in the head. Like, yes, guys like Gordon Ryan look really impressive when they're doing all this in jiu-jitsu tournaments, but people in jiu-jitsu tournaments don't have to worry about the strikes coming towards them. The thing that MMA grapplers have to worry about are strikes coming towards them. So I do think Munoz can have success on the bottom, even though Chalignon's best path to victory is probably going to be using his offensive wrestling, just so it least he can fight the fight under whatever terms he wants to. But I'll be honest, you've almost talked me more into a Johnny Munoz Jr. pick. I brought up some red flags. You've cut down a couple of them, if I'm being honest. Again, I do worry about the pace and the wrestling of a guy like Chalignon, but I think if Munoz can throw enough volume to at least make Chalignon uncomfortable on the feet, I think if that does open up some of the grappling exchanges, I will start to favor Johnny Munoz Jr.
Gyms for gym's sake, for Chalignon, you look at some of the pictures, he's out there with Mitch Raposo, who he fought him at one point. He's out there with Tony Ferguson. He's out there with Merab Dvalishvili. For Johnny Munoz Jr., a lot of time is Sequence, BJJ's, Dad's Gym, as well as Entram Gym in Tijuana. You've seen a strong connection with Brandon Moreno, and I know Moreno trains primarily now out of Glory MMA and Fitness, but still, a lot of great fighters to train your striking with there in Mexico. You look at the odds in the matchup. Munoz minus 200 hasn't really changed. Chalignon open plus 175. Still about there. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say over under 67.5% for Johnny Munoz Jr.
I think they're going to be close, but I will say over. Just because where the odds are, you might assume it's in like the 80%, but I think it'll be close because he has been underwhelming in the UFC.
Going to say the dude is over, and it's just under. 513 total votes, 65% Munoz, 79% by decision for the 35% that have Chalignon, 83% by decision. So most people seeing this one going the way of a decision. For Chalignon, got kind of taken down, held down a lot in his last fight against Jack Shore, who is floating around the rankings. So a really tough fight for Munoz Jr., kind of getting to pick up the pieces. I thought he beat Manus. He definitely won his next fight, and he had a really tricky one his last time out when he was taking on Tony Gravely. And that fight that he had against Gravely was back in June, so it's been about 5 months since he fought Tony Gravely and got finished in that one. You're making a total pick on this one. I find this one tricky. Minus 200 on Munoz feels a little bit rich for my blood, but I'm going to take it in this one.
I do like Munoz in this fight, but again, this is one of those fights where it's a, hey, prove to me what you really are made of. Because again, I thought this is a fighter who was going to be on the borderline of the top 15 very soon into his UFC career, if not become a ranked fighter very early into his UFC career. So I do like Munoz in this fight, but I think we're both going to get a better idea as to really where both fighters, I guess, are going to sit in the division. Because if Shalinian is able to get the win over a guy like Munoz Jr., who again, we both think is a very skilled fighter, it's just a matter of putting it all together, Shalinian is going to really boost himself up the rankings. So I think this is going to be an entertaining fight. I think it's a skilled fight for how low down on the card it is, but I also have Munoz Jr.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you have in the matchup. Both of us going with Kid Kvenbo to get the win over Ludwig Shalinian. Big time fights left on this card. Magny taking on Rodriguez. Rodriguez taking on Lemos. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Strawweights who are on the outside looking in, coming up this weekend, looking for a little bit of job security. We have the nuclear medicine specialist, Jinyu Fry, taking on a mugger's worst nightmare, Pollyanna Viana. And coming up in this matchup, you have a look, and it really is a weird one. With Pollyanna Viana, I have a hard time, because if you consider it, she is a former jungle strawweight champion, jungle fights rather, fight strawweight fight. Champion. And if you go and you look on the Tapology page, she fought Amanda Ribas to win that fight. She won that fight by knockout. You go watch it, because it's readily available on the internet. Oh my gosh, was that a slugfest for as long as it lasted. They just threw and threw and threw, and Viana continues to throw. Ribas shoots for a takedown. I'll show you a picture of what it looks like, because she hits the splits. And Viana's counter to the takedown is to throw like a Nate Diaz slap.
Stockton.
It doesn't land. Ribas gets back up. She gets dropped. And then, you know, ground and pound finish for Pollyanna Viana. But if you do consider it for Pollyanna in the UFC, she beats Maya Stevenson, which is a win on the record. She goes on a losing streak. Loses to JJ Aldrich. Loses to Hannah Cyphers. Loses to Veronica Macedo in a fight where it was over very quickly. She beats Emily Whitmire in the first round. She gets a performance bonus beating Mallory Martin in the first round. Both fights went about the same way. If you're going to fight Pollyanna Viana, you might not want to wrestle, because she has a very, very good full guard. And if you look at it, armbar wins in both of those fights. She goes against Tabitha Ricci her last time out. Has a big height advantage. Has a big reach advantage. Tabitha, Muay Thai accredited, Jiu-Jitsu accredited, and Ricci took her down and controlled her for long periods in that fight.
Pollyanna Viana reminds me of when you're playing like a new 2K video game or like a new Madden video game and you're making your My Career player. You know, early on, you just want to be good at one thing, so you can at least do that one thing to just get stats to then acquire points to level up in others. Like, I always try to shoot three-pointers with my 2K character, so I level up my three-pointer before I do anything else. Pollyanna feels like she's done that a lot with her bottom game in her jiu-jitsu, but the other things haven't necessarily progressed along with that one skill set, and it has been somewhat disappointing to see the progression of her throughout the UFC. And I do agree with you wholeheartedly with how you set this up. Both these fighters are basically just fighting for job security at this point. It's kind of wild to say, because let's just take ourselves back to when they first came into the UFC, because I can be very honest about where I originally rate fighters when they come into the UFC and where I rate them right now. I had a very high opinion of both these fighters when they had originally joined the organization, but that's the thing about the UFC and even about other organizations when you get to the top near championship level, but to the UFC in the most part, especially when you fight ranked fighters, you are fighting the best fighters in the world. And it's like being in a playoff in any other sport. When you're in the playoffs and you're playing the same team multiple games in a row, your weaknesses start to show game after game. And for Pollyanna and for Jinyu Fry, we can talk more about their weaknesses and get more in-depth into them, of course. But I really do feel like once they have started to fight the more upper echelon fighters in the world, and that's the thing you must say, it's not like they're fighting people like BJ Penn outside of Buffalo Wild Wings. They are fighting UFC caliber fighters at the top of their careers. But it's like what I just said about Johnny Munoz Jr. He's 1-2 in the UFC, and he's a very skilled fighter, don't get me wrong, but you look at his one win, and okay, it's Jamie Simmons. You might look at that, and that's almost like a regional opponent, right? Like, he could almost be 0-2 in the UFC, but have Simmons as like his last win coming off the regional scene. For Pollyanna Viana, we look at her two last wins in the UFC, they're not the highest level wins, and I do expect a lot more from her, but that's what I do really question in this fight.
I think Paul Yeda, of course, is going to have a physicality advantage. The conversation, of course, with Jin Yufrei is always that, hey, she was the atomweight champion of Invicta. It's not like she's the strawweight champion coming over like Angela Hill did all those years ago. She's the atomweight champion who was forced to move up in weight. And the thing was, she lost to Kay Hansen in her UFC debut. Kay Hansen's no longer with the organization. And I know Jin Yufrei had had some success early on in that fight. She had opened that cut on Kay Hansen, but still, Freya's in the organization, even though she's lost to some fighters who I wouldn't say are necessarily upper echelon fighters in the strawweight division.
Jin Yufrei, if you consider it, loses to Kay Hansen, gets outstruck by Loma Lookbonmi, can't really initiate many of the takedowns. She goes out there and she fights a couple of fighters that you would think, maybe if Jin Yufrei's got an opportunity, she's going to win those matchups. She takes on Gloria DePaola, looked very good in that fight. She takes on Ashley Yoder, looked very good in that fight. She takes on Vanessa Demopoulos. She loses a split decision there. If you look at it, MMA decisions, 9 had it 29-28 for Fry, 2 had it 30-27 for Fry, 1 had it 29-28 for Demopoulos. To me, it really was the nice 1-2s for Jin Yufrei. I thought she was able to get the win in that matchup. I had her, you know, after round 2, I even had it 30-27 for Jin Yufrei when I watched it the first time.
And the fact that Pollyanna stands so high up with her defense, especially on the feet, do you think that is going to make her more susceptible to some of those boxing combinations of Jin Yufrei on the feet?
It's a lot of 1-2s out of Jin Yufrei. It's a lot of walking forward. It's a little bit tough to decipher out of a southpaw like that. But for Pollyanna, like, I've watched her in the pocket drop her hands and wait a second against Hannah Cyphers. Cyphers lands a left overhand and it drops Pollyanna Viana. So I gotta be honest with all the Fight Night Picks fans out here. You're looking at just the pure numbers. You're looking at the wins. You're looking at the losses. How do I pick a winner in this fight? Boy, should I put my hard-earned money on this fight. Not a gosh darn chance.
You guys work too damn hard, and so do we.
Popping popcorn in this one. You consider it for Viana in the UFC. Net positive striker, 3.35 to 2.79.
Surprising to see, honestly, if that's fair to say.
For Fry, net negative striker, 3.12 to 4.13. And she's only landed about a third of her takedowns four in the UFC, has Jin Yufrei. So I look at the odds here. Fry open to plus 120 underdog, minus 106 is a slight underdog. Pollyanna Viana open minus 140, minus 117. Let's have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. It's a surprise to us as it is to you. I'm going to say over under 55% Pollyanna Viana. You can tell how much confidence I have in this one.
I think it'll be under.
It's going to be under? It's over. 529 total votes, 69% Viana, 58% by decision, 37% by submission. For the 31% that have 37-year-old Jin Yufrei, 90% by decision in this one.
So I felt like I was going to be this hipster and say, oh, I have the slight underdog. I have Pollyanna Viana, but...
Well, she's a favorite right now.
Isn't she plus 100?
You looking at Tapology? Best fight odds right now. Pollyanna Viana, minus 117. Jin Yufrei, minus 106.
I do like Pollyanna. I think they do have very similar skill sets. That's the honest truth. I know Jin Yufrei has probably the higher level credentials, if you will. She is the Invicta champion. She has some very good wins over the likes of Mina Grusander over there. But the thing is, I don't feel like Fry has physically fit into the strawweight division all that well. And for Pollyanna, she's a big fighter for the division. She's very tall with the way that she stands. And I do think that Fry can have some success on the feet. But I think once it hits the mat, Viana is the bigger fighter. I think she's gonna be able to wrap her up somewhat. I don't think this is going to be the most aesthetically pleasing fight, if you will, but I do ever so slightly favor Pollyanna in the matchup.
If you do consider it, Fry getting the win over Ashley Yoder, that is a little bit of
a similar
size matchup if you consider somebody like Pollyanna Viana. If you do look at this fight though, Viana's it's been done before, obviously, with somebody like Tabitha Ricci, much smaller, held her down for long periods of time in that matchup. I have Pollyanna Viana ever so slightly based on a little bit more volume from what we've seen out of her UFC tenure. But again, for Fry, we saw it against Demopoulos. We saw it against Yoder. She was able to have those advantages, throwing a lot of volume. Jaron Vallell scored at 30-27 Demopoulos because maybe mistook Fry for Demopoulos on the sheet. I don't know what happened in that one. But if we're making a pick on this one, I'll leave it up to you folks. Let us know down below in the comment section. Help the channel. Tell us who you have. Some big matchups to come, including a possible fight of the night in the next fight. Mario Bautista's taking on one tricky fighter in the returning Benito Lopez. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
And a welcome back to Oroville, California's own budding superstar in 2019. It was Benito Lopez, the golden boy. He's going to be taking on Mario Bautista. Now, from parts unknown, all of a sudden, Benito Lopez returning to us. I don't know where he's been.
I'd be back.
You go over to his Instagram, he looks like he has, I said, a budding superstar. He's got a budding family. He's become a real estate agent in the last little bit.
Good for him.
It's kind of confusing why a guy was 25 at 10-1 and decided to really drop things off. And there's no interviews that I could find of him. And this is Sunday before the fight, so I couldn't really find much. But what I do know out of Benito Lopez is, this guy was a damn impressive fighter coming off of Dana White's Tuesday Night Contender Series, because that's what it was called, in 2017. And for Lopez, he was the original all-action fighter off that season. Beats Steven Peterson by split decision there. Beats Albert Morales. He's able to drop him a couple of times in the first round of their fight.
Really impressive.
Loses to Manny Bermudez, the Bermudez Triangle. Loses to him by guillotine. Bermudez was undefeated at the time. Weighed in 140 pounds for bantamweight, which became a Bermuda staple. And so for Benito Lopez, he goes out and fights Vince Morales. He wins that fight. Wink, that was the original Arlovsky Collier, because I don't know what judges were watching that fight, but Vince Morales should have won it.
Sure.
But just records on a page, Benito Lopez, very impressive. And if you go back and you look at everything, you like Mario Bautista? You like what you see right now? Benito Lopez was that guy. You like flying knees? Go watch Benito Lopez when he fought Albert Morales. It was
super explosive.
Flying knees. And the craziest part for Lopez is you see it stats on a page. He's 5'10 at bantamweight. He really does have a long frame. Uses it very, very well. Long range boxing combinations he'll use. He'll throw some kicks and mix them in here and there. Throws a nice little bit of a low kick. But he gets his knee up so damn quick out of those flying knees.
It's Dan Hooker-esque. That's the fighter I was going to bring up.
Or Mario Bautista's Benito Lopez-esque. That's the thing. Both of these guys absolutely love the flying knees. And I say that because Bautista at this point, 10-2. He's fought more recently. He is slightly older. But that is a hallmark of Bautista's game. Even from when he was taking on Corey Sandhagen early on in his UFC tenure for Bautista.
Let's think about Mario Bautista. I'm a little surprised in the matchmaking of this fight, if I am being completely honest, because it feels like an NBA team had a pick in the top 10, and then they had another pick in just the top 30, like 20-30. So they've got a lottery pick and then another guy in the top or in the first round. Now they're making them play one-on-one. They know who they picked in the lottery, though, and they know who they picked near the end of the first round. I just feel like, to me, and I've been wrong before, I'm going to be wrong again in the future, Mario Bautista is a much more refined mixed martial artist. And maybe I'm only saying that because I've had a much more fresh idea as to what kind of a fighter he is, especially against top-level competition as of late. But the thing about Mario Bautista is he's going to throw compact boxing combinations. He's going to lunge in with his power shots a little bit too much, if we're all being honest. But that's the thing. If you throw with a lot of power, you're going to wind up at a certain point. Not everybody's a Vanderlei Silva and can get away with it for years and years and years. Like, they're going to come for the payment at a certain point. For Mario Bautista, we have seen him get clipped because he is so power heavy with some of his own strikes. And maybe Benito Lopez can take advantage of some of those defensive lapses we have seen out of Mario Bautista. But the thing is, and I guess this is the question. There's no right answer to it, so I'm putting you in a lose-lose situation.
Thanks.
But if Mario Bautista and Trevor Jones fought 100 times, Mario Bautista's probably winning 60 of those. I know he didn't win in their first fight.
And Timur Valiyev's going to win 90 of them.
That's a good point. But you know what I mean? Like, for Mario Bautista, I'm not right just because I'm saying this, to quote Chael Sonnen, but at least to me, I rate Mario Bautista a little bit higher. I think he has a little bit higher of a ceiling. I just think that he has very obvious strengths and very obvious weaknesses. And that's the issue with a fighter like Bautista. We always know what kind of fight he's going to excel in. He's a great power puncher. He has good wrestling. We know what his skill set is. But the problem is, he's one of these fighters who, to get the fight in the place where he's going to have the most success, is also going to make him open against some of these other strikers. And a guy like Lopez, I think, can take advantage of that.
Yeah, Lopez is a good long-range type of guy. He can mix it up in the pocket. You saw that in the fight against Albert Morales. And I mean, for Lopez, he's 2-0 against Morales in the UFC. And I'll show you the last time we even scratched the surface, mentioned Benito Lopez's name. We're going to react to this right now. I'm not going to add it in post. This is the last time that we talked about him. Look at that, Matt.
The hair was short. That's 3 studios ago. Jermaine Durandamy, Aspen Ladd. That was Fight Night Sacramento. We had, who is it? John Jones in the background. You had Daniel Cormier. Gustafson was the poster in the background, too. And there was a picture of Cormier. And look at us now. So things have definitely changed. But for Lopez, longtime Team Alpha Male guy. He was compared a lot to his teammate Andre Feely coming into the UFC. And for Lopez, didn't really use his offensive wrestling all that much. It was more he had good defensive grappling and good submissions to get himself out of bad positions to get back up on the feet to strike once more. He's been getting ready at Oroville BJJ close to home to get ready for this fight. I really like Benito Lopez 3 years ago, 4 years ago, 5 years ago. I have no idea what I'm going to get this weekend. If it's anything close to what it was, we're going to have a lot of fun. And I'm glad he's back because I've talked about Benito Lopez over the years on the channel. Bautista just beat Brian Kelleher not that long ago. Used boxing combination to close the distance to get him down really easy and submitted him pretty easy. Like, it was just crazy to see. So for Bautista, I've seen interviews where he's talked about, hey, if I win this fight, I want to rank fighter next, which is a little bit of a head scratcher just based on the layoff for Lopez. But when I do consider this fight, Matt, like, you look at Bautista, consistently training at MMA Lab with Sean O'Malley and Kyler Phillips. I think you're ready for a fight like this. You beat in competition that you should beat. Yes, the loss to Trevin Jones scares me. The fight of the night against Jinsu Sun makes me go, geez. I mean, Jinsu Sun had a fight of the night with Piotr Jan, and Piotr Jan, who's that guy
anymore? Maybe he doesn't want to be here anymore.
I don't know. Like Askar Askarov. But when I do consider this fight, Matt, Bautista open a minus 260 favorite, minus 240 right now. Benito Lopez open plus 220, plus 190. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us, they are to you. Matt, my heart of hearts, I always wanted Benito Lopez to come back.
Fair.
But not against Mario Bautista. Not this soon. Like, fight somebody off of Contender Series that you know.
Like, would you... Mario Bautista is one of those unranked fighters that I guess... I assume I think higher of him than the general consensus is. But maybe you agree with me. Like, is he another one of those unranked guys that kind of stands out to you?
I was hot and horny about him, like, from the Corey Sandhagen fight. From the jump.
No, that's
so
fair. Exactly.
That's kind of the thing. And I thought he performed well until he ended up getting finished. So, for me, over-under Topology votes, I'll say...
I think it's over gonna be under. High.
Yeah, it's going to be. It hurts my feelings. 75% Bautista.
I was going to say like 82, so I'll say
it's above. Way over. Yeah. 564 total votes, 92% Bautista, 63% by decision for the 8% that have Lopez, 67% by decision. I like Benito Lopez, guys. Like, I love his boxing from. I love watching him fight. I love his long range boxing attacks. You missed 3 years. I don't know what you're going to look like. I've seen Bautista more often than not. I like the way that he closes the gap against long-range guys. I love the takedowns and the grappling out of Bautista. So for those reasons, I have Bautista in the fight. I just miss Lopez, and I hope he looks good this weekend.
My reaction was only so big because when you originally said I like Lopez, I thought the pick was going to be Benito Lopez. But I share the same opinions that you have on this fight.
One more thing. Benito Lopez training primarily with Tyler Diamond for the matchup, a guy who was on The Ultimate Fighter, a guy who will mix it up, take it down, close the gap. Perfect guy to train for, but yeah, it's Bautista.
Tyler Diamond. Who did you mention with Mario Bautista? Sorry. Kyler Phillips, Sean O'Malley. Some of the greatest fighters in the weight class. And that's the thing. I think this is one of those right time, wrong opportunity situations for Benito Lopez. I agree with you. I think he is a very skilled fighter, and I think he is the right opponent. He could look really good in this type of comeback fight, but to me, this really does feel like the UFC is trying to further Mario Bautista's pursuit of a top 15 opponent, but that's the wild thing about bantamweight. Like, for Bautista, he would make this a 3-fight winning streak if he is able to get the win this weekend, but he still might be on the outside of the top 15 because that's how good the bantamweight division is right now, but I do have Mario Bautista in this fight, but I think it'll be a very entertaining one.
It is a big time fight coming up this weekend. Let us know who you have down below in the comments section. Both of us going with Mario Bautista to get the win, bringing it back to Arizona. Some big time fights left on this card. Neil Magny's taking on Dana Rodriguez. Marina Rodriguez taking on Amanda Lemos. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
in a fight that was originally booked for UFC 278. A couple of flyweights that were ready to square off in Salt Lake City, Utah. We have Miranda Maverick taking on Shannon Young. Unfortunately, Young was hospitalized on the Friday of weigh-ins due to what we assume was weight cut issue. But for Young, she gets the opportunity to take on Maverick. Coming up this weekend, we're going to throw it back to the original prediction that we had done for UFC 278. The particulars of the fight game have not changed. We'll update you with the odds and we'll make a final pick and prediction on the fight. We have Fear Thee, Miranda Maverick, taking on the Shanimal, change the nickname, Shanna Young, who switched up camps here recently, found success in her last fight with that switch up, a finish win over Gina Mazzani. Back mounted, hammering away, TKO, big win for the Shanimal, her first win in a meaningful amount of time, because before that, a win over Maiju Suotama back 2 years and 9 months ago. And for Shanna Young, it's been an odd run. I mean, she loses to Sarah Alpar in Dana White's Contender Series, loses to Macy Chasson in a short notice debut, loses to Stephanie Egger. And in all of those fights, it was the threat of the takedown that was really her downfall. And if you do look at it in the original fight between Shannon Young and Miranda Maverick, they didn't have any time to train for each other. It was the luck of the draw in the tournament. Maverick goes out there with her southpaw stance, tries to throw some strikes. Shannon Young stood a little bit taller than she normally does. She usually keeps a low base against wrestlers. She was starting to work her strikes. Maverick went for one, and then she was kind of on her tippy toes. Shannon Young pushes her with a jab, kind of stumbles her backwards. Maverick trying to gain her balance. Young initiates a clinch. Maverick gets it down to the mat. As Young's trying to get back up against the fence, Maverick gets the back, then sinks in the choke. And then Miranda Maverick's kind of off to the races. And for Shannon Young, it's kind of been a little bit of a mixed bag. Now, I do have this for Shannon Young, that big camp change over to Syndicate MMA. That really did kind of light a fire back under her. She used to be a fighter out of Knoxville Martial Arts, the Kings, Emily and Jason out of that gym. You have OSP there as well. But for Shannon Young, she's a bit of an odd duck because she has a high school and collegiate background in wrestling. We don't really see that in her fights. But then she also has a karate background, and that very much is the kind of, you know, where the bread gets buttered in most of her game. It's an odd stance that we don't see very often.
That's the weird thing about MMA. Like, you can have all the accolades in one given martial art that you want, but then you don't really translate it all that well to mixed martial arts. It's just really weird how some people can sort of use their base in a much more effective manner. Like, think of a Gilbert Burns, for instance. He comes from a much higher level background, but still, his jiu-jitsu outside the cage, on the streets, if you will, pretty good. His jiu-jitsu in the cage, also very good. But for Young, I always did expect more from her offense. Defensively with her takedowns, but just feels like defensively she is such a liability that, like you said, even in a lot of these clinches, she doesn't even look that comfortable in them because she's always going to have to worry about the offensive disadvantage that she's going to have in the wrestling. And for Maverick, I kind of expect her to just go back to the same thing she did in their first fight. And I do feel like she's improved more since their first fight. And I know that might be weird because they have very similar records since then. They're both 1-2 in their last three. But Miranda Maverick has had close competitive fights against fairly good fighters in the division, whereas Young has just struggled so much with the defense, with her takedowns, that I don't really know how she's ever going to fix that hole in her game. Like, I don't know if Shayna Young's ever going to be able to get past that learning curve of her wrestling defense, because I'll give her striking credit. If she is able to keep it on the feet, she does have pretty good power for the division. She is good offensively with her takedowns, but the issue is Miranda Maverick has shown the ability to defend a lot of takedowns, and she does have decent takedown defense late into fights. So if you're a Shayna Young believer, you might be hanging your hat on, okay, Miranda Maverick might not look great as this fight continues. Maybe she almost looks too good in the first two rounds, but I just don't know what Shayna Young is going to do to have a long, sustainable game plan in this matchup.
Like, Shayna Young in her last fight against Gina Mazzani, round number one, Mazzani was a woman possessed. She landed one of those knees in the clinch that dropped Shayna Young, like when Uriah Hall fought Paulo Costa, because Young just dropped her knees to the mat and then popped right back up really quick. And then Mazzani was out of juice. The Energizer Bunny ran dry. And then the second round, Shannon Young was really able to take over. So credit where it is due, because defending a takedown, forcing the action on the mat, finishing it in a spot where Mazzani's usually able to flow. You remember the fight against Rachel Ostovich that Gina Mazzani had. Wow. Really going back into the memory bank there. For Miranda Maverick, though, again, I mean, we have seen some big fights here. She does a good job with her double legs in open space, running the pipe, continuing to pressure forward with those takedowns and some big beatdowns in certain fights. And
for Maverick in the UFC. The loss to Macy Barber by split decision. Most people thought Maverick won, but it's still a loss on the page. The loss to Aaron Blanchfield, which was kind of a cobbled together short notice affair where Blanchfield was the favorite and was really able to win all over the place. The fight against Sabina Mazo, a little bit of strike for strike, but it really was a big time beatdown. Round one, round two. Poor Sabina Mazo. All right, so for Fear, the Miranda Maverick opened at a minus 300. The line jumped up and it hasn't gone back. She's a minus 555 favorite. Shannon Young's and Eric Code at plus 404. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise to us as they are to you.
Is it though?
I'm going to say over under 90% Maverick.
I think it's going to be over.
It's way over. 556 total votes, 96% Maverick, 42% by decision, 46% by submission. For the 4% that have Young, 62% by decision. Miranda Maverick's beaten Shannon Young before. She kind of dropped off the push, but she gets the takedowns. Like, I look at this matchup, I think Maverick's going to have success in the same areas that she had success in the Invicta Phoenix Series Rising tournament that she did. And I think that Maverick's going to be able to get the win in this matchup. Now, Young, again, she did look pretty good. Kind of, you know, second round taking over against Mazzani. Mazzani, adrenaline dump, cardio dump. But yeah, I do like Maverick here.
I think Shannon Young is a fighter who does have lasting ability in some of her fights. If she is able to fight it under the range that she wants to. But the problem is, we've seen Young struggle with her wrestling defense so much in the past that I do think a fighter like Miranda Maverick, who uses her offensive wrestling as a core component of her game plan, to have a lot of success against Young. So I do think Maverick is going to at least somewhat get back on track to the hype that she had once originally had. But that's the weird thing for Maverick. She's always going to be that fighter that she almost wants. Was so for Maverick, hopefully she is able to get back on track at some point. But again, she had such a high expectations for her coming into the UFC. I always go back to when John Anakin said, hey, she might be the second best women's flyweight in the world right now, and I understand it. She had a very impressive debut, but still, for a fighter to have that kind of a label put on them when the best fighter in the division, someone like Valentina Shevchenko, it's a lot to live up to. So hopefully for Maverick, she can look really good in this performance, and I do expect her to.
Matt calling a 25-year-old once was. Ooh,
that's... Well, no, but she had so much hype. Think about a fighter like Macy Barber. Remember how people used to talk about Macy Barber? It's like talking about Anthony Davis in 2019. People talked about him like he was one of the best players in the world.
And you're like, talking about her like she's Anthony Bennett.
No, but my point is, like, you're a casual NBA fan, I would say. Like, you have a favorite team, but you're not somebody who stays up every night and watches a lot of games.
Better things to do.
When was the last time you heard about Anthony Davis? Like, Anthony Davis, you probably haven't heard about him in years since they won the title.
Nice, hot think, to start the year.
For Miranda Maverick, I just think for her, it always really is important for her not only to get wins, but I feel like for her, it's an extra additive to look really impressive in a performance. I feel like this is an opponent for her to be able to do that.
Coming up this weekend, both of us going with Fear the Miranda Maverick to get the win. Let us know down below if you have Syndicate's own Shannon Young to get it done. We have some big time fights left on this card. Daniel Rodriguez taking on Neil Magny in the main event. Oh boy, Marina Rodriguez taking on Amanda Lemos. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Up this weekend in a battle of grappler versus grappler, we have Derek Minner representing Glory MMA and Fitness taking on the Wolverine Shailan Nordambeka. And in this matchup, if you told me a year and a half ago that Derek Minner was going to be an underdog against Shailan Nordambeka, I would have laughed in your face. But at this point, it's probably warranted. I mean, it probably makes sense why it is there. And I'm going to break it down a lot of different ways. But for Nordambeka, the reason why I didn't have the highest of regard for him coming into the UFC was because I wasn't sure how his wrestling was going to translate into the UFC. Decent boxing combinations, but in a fight against Rong Zhu, it was a quick right hand down the pipe that dropped Nordambeka. He ends up getting finished in that fight. And it was only a few more fights later where he was making his UFC debut, taking on Joshua Kolibau. Now, he got out everything in that fight, wasn't able to get his wrestling going, totally out volume, Kolibau gets the win. So for Nordambeka, his next time out, he's taking on Sean Soriano, and I thought, well, Soriano gets taken down, like it's, you know, nobody's business.
He can strike, though.
Soriano's a good striker. We knew that coming into the UFC back in, what, like 2014? We knew that now when he made his second time out with the UFC. And in that matchup, Nordambeka takes it down to the mat, and he ends up getting a decision win. So then his next time out, he takes on TJ Brown. I went, you know what? I'm doubting Nordambeka again. I'm not picking him to win this fight.
TJ Brown was about a minus 200 favorite. Nordum Becca was plus 175. And in that matchup, Shayulan was able to get the win, and it was a relatively close fight, but he clipped Brown with an overhand right in the first round, dropped him. They had a lot of big-time wrestling exchanges. Third round, Brown tries to kind of unload the gas tank right at the end, and Brown was trying to get the finish. The trouble for me is you fight a guy like TJ Brown. Well, Derek Minner's his teammate. Brown and Minner fight in similar ways. Brown's a little bit better of a striker. Minner might be a little bit better with some of his top pressure. But in the matchup that Shayulan had against Brown, we saw the Gaspar go down a little bit. You look at him right now training at Killcliff FC with the China top team guys. I mean, those guys are yoked. And for Nordum Becca, that's kind of a big thing. Like, coming into the UFC, you thought, hey, is it going to be lightweight? What is it going to be? And then he was making the move down to featherweight, and I had questions. I still have some questions around his gas tank. The guy's wrestling's powerful. He out-wrestled Brown at the start. He had him in a lot of compromising positions. I've been really impressed with Shayulan Nordum Becca. The other thing, he should have been 20-7 after he beat Sean Soriano, and then he ends up at 38-10. So yeah. The record get added and whatever that is. You know, with Tapology, with Sherdog, they have Fight Finder. Check it out. But for Nordum Becca, the skills are there. He's impressed me in the UFC. I picked against him in three fights. I'm 1-2, and he's 2-1, so good for him.
And for Nordum Becca, he showed that his wrestling explosiveness does translate into striking his last time out. I think that's a very important thing to demonstrate, because against someone like Derek Minner, who, again, is basic on the feet, he's all right. But again, the thing
is, he's economical.
That's a good way of describing it. Yes, he has a very basic game plan on the feet. Again, most of the stuff he does on the feet is to work the fight to the ground and then to try to get top pressure. But that's the thing I'll be very interested in, to see if Minner can try to go for sweeps and to see how active he is off his back. Because Minner is going to invite a lot of the grappling, I think, in this matchup. But the thing is, he's going to want to end up in the top position. And the top position is going to be very important. When you have two primary strikers, we normally talk about, hey, the outside foot position, who's moving forward, things like that. Well, between two grapplers, it's really going to come down to who gets the top position, because if Derek Minner can get on top of Nordum Becca, he's going to look way better than him. He's going to be able to threaten with submissions, go against his guard, threaten across his guard, and really try to go for different ground and pound and submissions. And I would say this, Minner probably has the better chance to get a finish in this fight. I think if Nordum Becca does get the win, it's going to be a lot of top control, it's going to be a lot of top pressure, but I don't know how effective he's going to be able to be with his own ground and pound, because if he does open up, create a lot of separation for his own strikes, that's going to help Minner try to move on the ground and create some separation. So, and again, you hate to say this, but I do it every single week, but for Nordum Becca, it might be beneficial for him to try to make this fight a little bit boring. Use your physicality, use your pace, use his clinch control too, because I'm looking at it right now on Tapology, and Nordum Becca is only listed as 1 inch taller, and he does have a shorter reach. I think he might be a little bit taller than 1 inch. I do look at him as a slightly more physical guy. Now, I'll be very interested to see how they do match up just against each other with the face-off, and you can't learn everything from a face-off. I'm not going to switch my prediction based off it, but at least to me, I do think Nordum Becca is going to have a bit of a physicality advantage in this matchup. But I think the grappling exchanges between these two guys, just to end it, are going to be very interesting, because Minner's going to be active off his back. He's not just going to sit there and try to get the ref to get them back up to the feet. So I will be interested to see how Nordum Becca reacts to the submissions that Minner goes for off his back.
Yeah, because I mean, Derek Minner's a Nikita Krylov type of grappler.
100%.
You're going to get submitted. You're going to submit some guys. And he has some really good wins on his record. Obviously for Minner, like, he's fought a high level of competition going way back to what? Like, let's pick one. 2014 fights Luke Sanders. Well, Luke Sanders was an RFA champ.
I thought he was going to be awesome.
You go up and down. Jesse Arnett, Chico Camus, who else? Jordan Griffin, Kevin Kroom, Clay Collard's the win. He beats Terrence McKinney. And how did he beat McKinney? McKinney rushes in for a takedown, gets the fight down to the mat, and then you have a reversal out of Derek Minner, and he submits him in the first minute. So there are Minner fights like that. Taking on TJ Laramie. Laramie, compact, big, gonna wrestle. What does Derek Minner do? Submits him very, very quickly. So if you're Minner, he even dropped Charles Rosa in that matchup. Now he takes on Darren Elkins, second to last fight, had a good first round. Didn't have a good second round. Got, like, beat
his pillar. Cardio fell off a cliff.
Pillar to post. Fought Ryan Hall. Fought one of the most confusing fights I've ever seen. He was booked against Damon Jackson earlier on this summer. What happened? Well, Jackson ended up fighting Dan Argueta, who's the mouthpiece for, Cub Swanson. But if you look at it for Minner, I read a weird headline. It's another All-Star MMA interview with JHK. The headline, Derek Minner details concussion symptoms / recovery. And I thought, oh boy. Like, is he like Mark Savard now? Like, we're going to retire a Bruin and never play
Tua Tagovailoa
hockey again? Well, Tua turned back the clock. He looked amazing today. This weekend. Yeah, how about that? But for Derek Minner, the conversation was his wife was due. He went home for the birth. And then he's training at the home gym, or the hometown gym. Goes with his sparring partner. They clash heads. And he gets a bit of a, he gets his bell rung. Goes home and he's puking. So he ended up with a concussion. Had to take about, a good 4 weeks, no nothing. 8 weeks really slow and then back into it for the full gamut of the testing. If you look at it for Nordenbeka, again, another camp training in the States, getting ready at Killcliffe FC. A lot of great training partners over there. Sean Soriano's holding the mitts. That's got to be awkward.
It must be.
It's got to be so awkward. You look at the odds in this fight, Matt. Minner open +170, +165. Nordenbeka open -200, -206. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say that they're probably going to be close. I'm going to say over under 62.5% Nordenbeka. It would surprise me.
Over.
Way over. Oh, it's way over. 474 total votes. 82% Nordenbeka. 79% by decision for the 18% that have Minner. 48% by decision. 38% by submission. Which makes some sense. Because, Derek Minner, again, kill or be killed type of grappler. But I say economical striking. He doesn't throw much out on the feet. He doesn't really absorb a whole lot on the feet. Against Darren Elkins, he absorbed everything. Like, everything. It was so bad.
I think Minner's going to get exhausted in the wrestling exchanges in this fight. And I came into this video thinking
Nordenbeka is the type of guy that happens to. Like, his second round against TJ Brown, he looked like the sails were out of the sailboat and were lost at sea.
But the thing is, we're talking about two fighters who, after that first 5 minutes, you're having some question marks about them. And at least, the way I'm thinking about it, maybe you can talk me out of this.
No.
Nordenbeka is the guy who is going to be able to dictate when the fight's on the mat and when the fight's on the feet. Now, yes, Minner, if he's able to get on top, I would say is the more lethal of the two. He has the higher probability of getting that submission finish if he's on top. But I think the wrestling is going to wear on Minner. I can see Minner trying to waste a lot of energy getting back up to his feet, wasting energy going for submissions off his back. And again, I came into this video kind of thinking I would pick Derek Minner. But the more that we've talked about this fight, I do find myself siding with Nordenbeka.
I like the size advantage of Shailan Nordenbeka. I don't like the cardio of either guy. So take that for what it's worth. And if you are looking at it going, well, if Nordenbeka slows, that opens up the door to a Minner submission, I would agree with you to a certain extent. So I'm gonna go with Shailan Nordenbeka. He just throws hammers on the feet, and we'll see how that plays out against Derek Minner. If you like Minner, let us know down below in the comment section. We have some big time fights, including Jailton Almeida taking on Max Grecian in the next one. Don't skip ahead. You're going to want to watch that one. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Originally due back in May, we finally get it. It's Malagino Jailton Almeida taking on Maximus Max Grecian, whose Instagram game is suspect. Yikes. And for Grecian, he's accepting this fight, and it's a tough one. Matt, I'm going to retire a saying. A saying that Fight Night Picks fans, they know and they love. Yeah, it's kind of crazy. You didn't expect any of this, but I name fights like this an odd bucket of muscles, but you know what? It's time to get rid of that. Do I have that prop laying around easily? No, because it would smell terrible. I'm going to call it this, Matt. It's an odd jar of pickled eggs. You know what? I'm a pickled eggs fan, and some people might not be, but for Jailton Almeida to take on Max Grecian, it's not necessarily a giant step up for Almeida. I'll argue, actually, that it is a step up for him. But if you do consider it, he was originally booked just last week to be taking on a tough guy in Shamil Abdurakhimov, a guy who hasn't won a fight in years, it should be said. But he's still ranked a 15-ranked guy at heavyweight. And for Almeida, that would have been an opportunity to get your foot in the door to the rankings. Now you're the next Sergey Spivak in this division. You get a chance, at least. For Almeida, you look at it, Matt, and the reason why I say it's a weird, jar of pickled eggs type of fight, your champion of lightweights, Islam Makhachev. What's the biggest thing? Never gets hit, right? Never gets hit. Takes guys down.
Marks them.
Jailton Almeida in the UFC takes on Danilo Marquez. Not a scratch on him. Takes on Parker Porter. Not a scratch on him. Somehow, Anton Turkal got one shot away. Jailton Almeida's strike differential in three UFC fights, 65-1.
Remember growing up, we used to watch a lot of music videos? I know this is really going back to the memory
bank.
I had
the Metallica music video DVD.
No, but remember when David Guetta had that song with Rihanna? Who's that chick? That's what I felt like when Shelton Almeida came onto the scene in the UFC. I'm like, wait, who's that chick? Boop, 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 boop. It's a banger of a tune from like 2011, guys. I highly recommend going
back. She's back.
But the thing about Shelton Almeida is I was not expecting him to have such a big splash when he came onto the scene. I was not hip to the Shelton Almeida hype train before he came to the UFC. I can openly admit that. Listen, there's some prospects that are going to fly under my radar. But oh my god, this guy has been impressive since he's been here. And I mentioned it earlier on in the card where you talked about the opening fight. It's, hey, not every prospect is someone like Shelton Almeida that you can get excited for and can kind of project them to be a ranked fighter. Because that's what I said. I didn't know who Shelton Almeida was before we had made the video on him getting ready for this channel. But the thing is, Craig and I go back, we watch some fights, we get ready for it. I didn't think Parker Porter had a damn chance when he fought Shelton Almeida when he fought him. And I think I have a much higher opinion than Parker Porter than the majority of MMA fans do. I just think for Shelton Almeida, there's prospects like this in every single division. I had talked a lot about Shavkat Rakhmonov when he was in welterweight. And hey,
In welterweight.
I know, but projecting a ceiling like that on any fighter is a very difficult thing to do. Like, my friends and I always say, like, oh, who do you think is going to be the NBA MVP before the season starts? You know, just those dumb kind of barbershop conversations, if you will. And the hardest award to get to every time is, who do you think most improved player is going to be? Because it could be anybody. It could be anybody who's going to take that big jump. For Shelton Almeida, not only did I expect a lot out of him when he did make his debut against Parker Porter, a much bigger guy in the heavyweight division.
No, his debut was Danilo Marquez.
Danilo Marquez. Not only did he look great against Danilo Marquez, but he kept on proving that size didn't matter in a division where size traditionally does matter. And that's the question I always have. Do you think Almeida will eventually go to 205, or will he just always be a light heavyweight?
Nah, give him the cruiserweight belt. Like, the craziest part about Almeida, and the thing that kind of turned me on to it, okay, you're outside of the UFC, you beat Arnaldo Oliveira, and you beat Ildemar Alcantara. Now, both guys later in their careers, but both UFC vets. You finish both of them, that's impressive. The Caio Bahalio, you beat him in a grappling tournament, and escape time, it is what it is. But you beat Nasruddin Nasruddinov over on Contender Series, and Nasruddinov was a Sambo champ, he was a wrestling great, and Almeida cut through him like butter. And the craziest part is, I watched all these interviews, I read all these things about Almeida before he made his UFC debut, and he called himself the Brazilian Khabib. But he looks like Edge in, like, 2005. He just goes across the cage.
You think you know me.
He spears the guys. He wraps their legs. He waits for you to make the mistake to turn your back, and then he submits you. He does it to Parker Porter. Anton Turkal trains at a great gym over in Sweden. What gym does he train at?
All-Stars.
All-Stars. He's a great wrestler. He's a great grappler. He did exactly that to him his last time out. Now Turkal moving up from 205 on short notice, taking that fight. It was one of those catchweight cruiserweight. It was at 220 pounds. Almeida over there just takes his time, breaks him down, rear naked choke. So 3 wins in the UFC, all by finish. The win on Dana White's Contender Series last year. Now he's taking on Max Grecian. Grecian has decent takedown defense. His last fight at heavyweight was a short notice debut where he loses to a guy in Marcin Tybura who's kind of plodding forward, big guy, works his takedowns. And in that fight, that was a scoop. But Grecian's beat guys like Jordan Johnson, a very good wrestler that was in the UFC.
Would you agree with me, though? Shelton Almeida displays a rare level of athleticism to be in MMA. Like, normally you look at high-level athletes and you think, okay, NFL, NBA, the sports that have a lot of money associated with them. But for Shelton Almeida, he does seem to have a physical strength that is almost out of what he is, because he is a small guy for the division.
I don't know if I'd say small. Like, he's got a size advantage on a lot of guys. And he's competing. Like, the fight that he had against Parker Porter, I guess, is the outlier where Porter's a heavy, heavyweight.
But he still out-muscled him, though.
And Almeida had a lot of success there. But if we do focus on Grecian, I mean, he's a master of sport and army hand-to-hand combat. And if you do consider it, Grecian's got really good combinations on the feet. I thought he beat Dustin Jacoby, but I didn't think Cole Roundtree did. But out of Grecian, I mean, he's basically the same guy from round 1 to round 3. Steady. He throws some of the best leg kicks you're going to find in the light heavyweight division. And if he's able to defend a few of these takedowns and force us into a stand-up fight, Almeida's one of those guys that I say he lunges into these takedowns, he spears into them. But he really does try and force a lot of the blitzes and a lot of his strikes, and he really could get caught by a counter from Grecian in this fight.
He could, but if he gets him down one time. Like, Jaltan Almeida has this rare kind of weight to him where he is like a lead blanket when he gets on top of these guys. You look at him in the heavyweight division, and he doesn't look like a large fighter by any means, but still.
I think he does.
You're right. I guess physically he does, but he doesn't weigh as much as all these other guys. And against Grecian, who has competed at 205, you might not expect the size difference between Almeida and some of these other heavyweights, but that's why I think Almeida is going to look even more dominant with his own physicality. I really do think once he gets this fight to the mat, he's going to have a lot of success. And that's the thing. Grecian is a very skilled fighter, but Grecian's an older 205er making his sort of step into the heavyweight division, whereas Jaltan Almeida is explosive as all get out. And I know he's 31 years old, but like 31 in the heavyweight division is like 21 in the bantamweight division. Like, you're going to be around for another decade probably, and you're going to be good for another decade. I just think maybe it's me just admitting my own bias, but I do think Jaltan Almeida is one of those next level prospects. I expect him to be in the top 15 for a good amount of time because his kind of X-Factor techniques stand out amongst X-Factor techniques in the top 15, and I think that is fair to say. So against someone, let's say Max Grecian had his skill set, but in like a Marcin Tybura's body, if that makes any sense, maybe that could offer Jaltan Almeida some problems. But I do think Grecian going in there physically, being a similar size to someone like Almeida, is going to offer him a lot of troubles. And I do think Almeida, with his own grappling style, especially when he gets in that top position, he is so heavy and so physically strong in that top position, I think he's gonna have a lot of success.
Your B-Dub-Dubs fact of the week: Max Grecian won a kickboxing fight, a pro kickboxing fight, by split decision in 2013 against Sokaju. Matt, did you know that?
I did not.
You can take that to the bank. Matt, when we do consider this one, Grecian's last time out weighed 206 pounds at light heavyweight against a 218-pound William Knight, who was supposed to be a light heavyweight, all three judges, 30-27.
What would I have to do to be built like William Knight? Is there a program I could get on? Like, would I have to get on that Icarus type program?
I've been lifting weights and I've been eating, I almost called them
sources of protein,
vinegar eggs, but pickled eggs, and I'm not ever going to be that big. But when I do consider the odds in this matchup, Matt, Almeida open to minus 700, minus 678, roughly, still about there. Max Grecian open plus 500, plus 469 over on Best Fight Odds. We have a look at the total votes on Tapology, Matt. Surprise to us, they are to you. I'm going to say over under 95% Almeida.
I think it's going to be over. I really do.
Oh, barely. 502 total votes, 96% Almeida, 70% by submission, 18% by knockout. For the 4% that have Grecian, 40% by decision, 30% by knockout. I think if Grecian wins, he knocks out Jaltan Almeida. Yep. On a pullback where Almeida's blitzing forward, I think Almeida will have success with his takedowns and he gets the win here. And I think Almeida wins this fight. If you can make a compelling argument for Grecian, I like Grecian's style at 205. I like what he brings to that division, even at 38. He's just, I talked about a guy recently being economical in Derek Minner because he doesn't get hit a ton when he's on the feet, but he also doesn't throw a lot on the feet. Grecian throws good volume, doesn't get tagged all that often, and he's beaten a decent level of competition. But in this one, just under the circumstances, I think Almeida gets the win here.
I can admit when I'm wrong on prospects, and I can pat myself on the back when I'm right about a prospect every now and then. I thought Shavkat Rakhmonov was going to be really good for a long time. I was called an idiot in my Twitter DMs because I thought he had a chance against Khamzat Chimaev, and I've been saying that for years now. Like, you can go back and watch our videos. I've been saying this for like a disturbing amount of time. Jaltan Almeida is another guy who I do project to have a very high ceiling in this division. And Jack De La Maddalena, Shavkat Rakhmonov, and Jaltan Almeida. Right now, I'll say they're all in the same category. Rakhmonov, I guess, now is a ranked fighter, so he's not really in that same category. But for Almeida, I do think he's going to have a lot of success with his offensive grappling against Grecian. I'll be a little interested to see how he looks on the feet if he's not able to get that offensive takedown over and over again. But I think Almeida will have a lot of success once he is able to get this fight to the mat.
If you know somebody at Strubs, they're proudly Canadian.
I don't.
Let them know that they're getting a plug here with Fight Night Picks and give us that pickled egg connection. Both of us going with Jaltan Almeida to get the win in the matchup. Some big-time fights left on this card, including Neil Magny and Daniel Rodriguez. Marina Rodriguez take on Amanda Lemos. Listen, you're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it.
Win streaks are on the line coming up this weekend at lightweight. Mark Madsen looking to hold on and retain that. Oh, he's taking on Grant Dawson, who has a near-perfect record, 18-1-1. For that top prospect, he's broken through. He wants to break into the ranks, and a win over Mark Madsen would definitely do him a lot of favors. And for Madsen, he came into the UFC a little bit late in the game. He came into MMA a bit late into the game, but he's definitely proved that his skill sets of wrestling, and Greco-Roman wrestling in particular, have translated very well. And if you look at it for Madsen, didn't get a medal in 2008 in Beijing, didn't get a medal in London in 2012, but in Rio, at about 32, he got it done, silver medal there, cross that one off, let's start MMA. He ends up into the UFC, debuts at home in Denmark against the Caterpillar, Danilo Belluardo.
That was a big deal, too. That's why I like it when they take fight nights on the road. I'm sorry, I don't mean to hijack your point, but I effing hate the fact that they keep on doing fight nights at the Apex. Like, give these fighters the opportunity to fight in front of their hometown crowds.
It's like that Lil Dicky song. They're saving that money.
They are, but you know what I mean? Like, even as a fan watching from home, even if you're watching on the TV, it feels like a much more immersive experience if you see the crowd really rally behind their own fighters. And I know you're going to get on board with the point I'm about to make. Remember when Gavin Tucker walked out in Halifax in the main card?
Biggest pop I've ever heard.
Gavin Tucker's somebody who a lot of you guys might not even know at this point. Like, he's a featherweight in the UFC, who's had some ups, has some downs, but he made his debut on a card in Halifax, which is kind of his adopted hometown, if you will. He grew up in this area of Canada that you call the Maritimes, and just sort of Halifax.
He grew up in Atlanta, Canada,
and this fight was sort of an extension of that. So it was a hometown crowd, and like you had said, he's not somebody who has the fanfare of a LeBron James, of a John Moran, of a Jason Tatum, but you would have thought that for the night. You know what I mean? Like, people in that crowd treated him like he was the king of the world. And that's what we don't get when we get these fight nights at the Apex in front of 15 people and only, like, friends and family. Like,
the king of Citadel Hill and the queen of Portland Street.
For Mark Madsen, he is somebody who, again, if you put him in front of the right crowd, he's going to get a pop like a national hero like you wouldn't believe. And I just feel like we do lose a lot from that when we get these shows at the Apex. It's always been a problem I've had. They keep on doing fight nights at the Apex. I hate it.
Well, stop pandering to Nova Scotia, but we do focus in on Mark Madsen. He beats Danilo Belluardo. He beats Austin Hubbard by decision. Slowed down a little bit as the fight went on. Hubbard had a little bit of an opportunity there, but a good win for Madsen. Beats Clay Guida by split decision, which was a tight one. His last time out, he beat Vince Pichel, and that was the first time that Madsen had gotten taken down in the UFC. It was a late second round takedown by Pichel. It was a single that he kind of turned into a double, cradled those legs, dumped him on his bottom, and ends up getting it in the round ends. But for Madsen, once he worked in his own takedowns, we know Pichel is really good with his boxing. Yeah. He's great with his mustache. He's poor with his takedown defense, and that's where Madsen was able to win out. But what I've seen in the last two fights, the Clay Guida fight, the Vince Pichel fight, Madsen doesn't have to go out there and wrestle from second, I guess, five after the glove touch to the end of the fight. He really has been comfortable with his hands. This is his third straight camp at Fight Ready. Eddie Cha, Santino DeFranco, great training partners. I'm sure the triple champ, Triple C, gets a little bit in there, gets into the mix, maybe the Korean Zombie as well. But for Madsen, I've seen him more active with his hands. I've seen some more leg kicks out of his game. I've seen the one fatal flaw still rear its ugly head, but I don't think it's going to get him finished against Grant Dawson. True. Every time in the boxing combinations that Mark Madsen makes, I don't know if it's a read or it's a tick or what it is. And if it is, I don't mean to make fun of him for it. So I will put that out there. He dips to his left every single time. He'll stop, he'll dip, he'll throw, he'll dip. He dips to his left every single time. And against a guy like Grant Dawson, who will switch his stances a lot, if he goes to southpaw, he dips to his left, and then he throws a counter hook, it could be a great time for Grant Dawson. If Grant Dawson even fought like that. He doesn't really fight like that.
I can personalize this because you're 100% right with the read that you've made on Mark Madsen. Did you ever have a tick in a sport that you played? I did in basketball.
I had a hitch in my swing in baseball.
Fair.
And when I went to play softball, I had to completely change my swing for a full year to where it was all the way back.
That's fair.
And then I pushed
in. So, I was a really good three-point shooter growing up. I can't hit free throws to save my life. Not that, like, the moment's too big for me, but I can openly admit this. I overthink the heck out of it. Because if I'm shooting a three, it's okay. I'm going to drive on the left side. I'm going to go into the paint. They're going to run a play called floppy for me. And it's just going to be a screen. I'm going to go into the left corner. I know what that
that is, it's like a mechanical thing I can do over and over again. With a free throw, it's like, hey, it's just you and all these people who are watching you do that thing. And for Madsen, it does feel like there is that disconnect with his striking offense in the cage. And you're right, against a guy like Grant Dawson, it might not get him caught. But that's one of those reads that in Mark Madsen, you're going to have to watch for every single opponent. Because, okay, let's say he does make that mistake against Grant Dawson. It's not going to get caught against Dawson. But if you beat him, you're probably fighting a ranked opponent next. And I think we all realize how good the top 15 in the lightweight division is. And that's the weird thing about this fight.
Winner gets Mateusz Gamrot, and I'm rock hard for it.
I've said this for a long time, though, and I think you agree with me. Mark Madsen, since he has gotten into the UFC so late in life, since he has such a good foundation, he is an Olympian, of course, that is his nickname, he was going to have that big step up in competition at a certain point. This is definitely that step up in competition, but I do feel like since it's against a guy whose strengths are very similar to Mark Madsen's strengths, it's not as dangerous of a fight as if he was fighting a guy who, let's say, had really good takedown defense and was a great striker. I can't think of anybody in the lightweight division off the top of my head, but just think of like a smaller Robert Whittaker type. Like for Madsen, this is a good step up in competition because Dawson is the more experienced guy against top levels of competition, but Dawson's areas of success are going to directly overlap with Mark Madsen.
And for Grant Dawson, been in the UFC for a time or two,
I was
consider
so high on him.
Made his UFC debut against Julian Arosa after winning on Dana White's Contender Series. He beats Mike Trezano, earns a performance bonus, beats Derek Minner, beats Nanarimani, Leonardo Santos, another performance bonus. He kind of come back, hammer fist, and then his last time out took on Jared Gordon. He does have a draw against Ricky Glenn, and it is like the 1996 Matchbox 20 hit. I'm gonna push you around.
Well, I will.
Well, I will. Because Ricky Glenn pushed him the F around in that third round. Ricky, call me Ricky now. He 10-8'd him in the third round. But for Grant Dawson, he is awkward striking, and he kind of does the Anthony Smith, like, Muay Thai knee
little
thing,
bit, yeah.
But it's not a net positive because he does lift his leg up there. He's got good kicks, but he will throw the kick and then do the old spinorama, which could get you caught. Grant Dawson to me is taking on a guy whose bare bones game is somewhat similar. Size-wise, striking-wise, not really wrestling-wise, but when the guy was winning wrestling-wise, Nadnirimani. I look at the Nirimani fight, I look at Mark Madsen, look at Nadnirimani's face at the end of that fight. It's bloodied right up. Dawson's having success in the striking. He had success in the wrestling and some of the grappling exchanges. If you do consider it, though, this is Dawson's second camp at American Top Team. He was a Long Glory MMA and fitness guy. The Matchbox 20, the Rob Thomas was too much for him, so he had to go down to American Top Team after the draw to Ricky Glenn. I'm eager to see, though, Madsen can take it to the mat. Can Grant Dawson take it to the mat? And I saw Vince Bichelle take it to the mat, which gives me a little bit of an idea that maybe Dawson can. But Dawson's takedowns, he really does like to go for that high crotch single leg and then work in some trips. He will go to your upper body. He will switch it around. But likes that high crotch entry. I'm wondering if Madsen's able to counter that because for Madsen, upper body, Greco-Roman throws, Greco-Roman wrestling. Will Dawson have success with some of those takedowns of his own here?
So we grew up in this rural area of Canada. It's just like the middle of nowhere. It's just a community.
It hasn't been established yet.
But exactly. And I just remember our grandparents saying this saying, and it's how much hay can you bale while the sun's up? And for Grant Dawson, I think he can get more done, and I do like his activity more in this matchup. I do agree with you. I think their primary skill sets do overlap quite a bit, but I think once you do start to get into the more nuanced areas of their game, Mass is a lot more control-oriented. I think you'd agree with me. If there's a finish in this fight, Grant Dawson is probably the one who's finishing Mark Madsen, whereas Mark Madsen, he can win this fight, but I much more see him as winning like a 30-27 decision where his wrestling is going to be positive from the first minute of the fight to the 15th minute of the fight, where I don't really see him getting into a lot of sticky situations. Whereas if Grant Dawson wins, it's going to be a lot of damage. It's going to be a lot of top control, a lot of ground and pound. And that's why I think this fight is so much fun. Because for Madsen, we all know how good his wrestling is. Again, there's not a lot of fighters in the UFC who are at that Olympic level in any singular area of their mixed martial arts game. But the fact that Madsen does, not only, he's not just an Olympian. Like, this guy has a medal in the Olympics, so Madsen's background cannot be overlooked. But I still think Grant Dawson's game is more suited towards MMA. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
40% takedown defense of Grant Dawson's stats on a page, Contender Series UFC included. Diaz went 1-for-2 on Contender Series. Minner went 1-of-1. and Santos went one of two. Those are the only people that tried to take down Grant Dawson, and that's the reason why it's 40% takedown defense. So we have a look at the odds. Dawson is favored to win, open minus 150, minus 222. Madsen on the comeback, open plus 130, plus 178. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise to us there to you. I'm going to say over under 70% Dawson, but I have a hard time here.
I think they're going to be under, I do.
And they are. So 437 total votes, 62% Dawson, 66% by decision for the 38% that have Madsen, 88% by decision. You tipped your hand, you get Dawson.
I do. I think he's the younger fighter. And like I said,
no way.
A lot of their primary skill sets do overlap. But when a guy is a decade younger, it's very harder to pick, or it's very difficult to pick, sorry, the more senior of the two in this matchup. Again, I think Mark Madsen does have a path to victory. If he uses offensive wrestling, it is very control-oriented. I think he can win this fight. But the thing is, Madsen is going to really rely on the judges and their scorecards, I think, to win this fight. Again, not saying he can't get finishes against guys who are at the UFC level. I think he's going to struggle to out-grapple Grant Dawson to the point where he submits him. You know what I mean?
And I said I think the winner would get a guy like Mateusz Gamrot. Dawson's been training with Gamrot to get ready for this one. Training with Thiago Moises. Training with Natan Schultz.
Some pretty good guys to train
for. So Moises and Gamrot are probably out of the equation. Schultz with the PFL. But I do like Dawson's ability to finish in this matchup. When I do look at everything part and parcel, who has the better ability to finish when it does come down to something like this? I'd say Dawson, but it is a tight fight, and I'm surprised the odds are that spread apart.
But I'll say this, good on Mark Madsen, because he doesn't have to take a fight this difficult, I don't think. I think he can go to the UFC and say, hey, I want more guys who I'm going to be a significant favorite over, because I am a big name in Europe in a country that you don't have a lot of fighters in. I think this is a significant step up in competition, and I just think at some points you have to apply a fighter for taking a difficult fight that they don't necessarily have to take. I think there's a world where, again, Mark Madsen continues to fight guys that he has a massive grappling advantage over. He just keeps on looking good in decision wins, and he never really takes that next step. This is that next step against a guy like Grant Dawson. That's why I'm excited for the fight, but I agree with you. I also have Dawson.
Both of us going with KGD to get the win coming up this weekend. Let us know what you have in the comments section. Really eager to hear your thoughts, because those Tapology votes are wonky and so are the odds. Some big time fights on this card, including Josh Parisian and Chase Sherman, you're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
How Nate Maness is going to make flyweight coming up this weekend is beyond me. He might show up with half an arm or a quarter of a leg. He's going to have his first fight at flyweight. And for Nate Maness, I mean, you look at it, he's the former Warrior FC lightweight champ, the former HR MMA featherweight champ, the former TKO in Quebec, Canada, bantamweight champ. Guys, I don't know how he's going to do it. Like, and I say all of this, and maybe it changes, so I'm going to throw it up as proof on the screen. UFC stats, Tapology, Twitter, the internet, they all say this fight's going to be at flyweight. Nate Maness is a tall, thin guy at bantamweight. And then I tried to rack my brain. Well, who is the tallest flyweight in UFC history? The only one that I could come up with, Matt, you don't like him, but I did, was Ulka Sasaki. He was 5'10 at flyweight. And Nate Maness is going to be 5'10 at flyweight.
Overrated.
So Maness is going to be really, really big, have a height advantage, have a length advantage on a lot of these guys in this division. And for Tagiro Ulambekov, that's normally his calling card.
Exactly.
Length, size, reach. He took on Tim Elliott his last time out. Most people thought Ulambekov won it. Now, Tim Elliott knocked him down in the first round with an overhand right. Tim Elliott, I mean, in quotes, the glove is part of the hand post-fight. So the glove is part of the hand. Yeah, I grabbed it. Sure, I grabbed it. I like that he admitted to it. But for Tagiro Ulambekov, I got to say, folks, I've had a bad read on him in the UFC. I picked his fights wrong, and I'll tell you why. I don't think of him as highly as a lot of other people do. I go back, you look at the record, he fought a great level of competition coming into the UFC. He was a GFC flyweight champ, he was a Fight Nights Global flyweight champ. He had the win over Vartan Asatryan, you gotta get the win.
And he's been a guy, if I may, who really has given the benefit of the doubt for the odds makers from the get-go in his UFC debut.
Oh, trust me, I'm gonna talk about
it. Okay, perfect.
He lost to Zhalgas Zhumagulov, lost his belt in 2018 by majority decision. So in the UFC, Matt, you alluded to it. Fights Bruno Silva, he's a minus 500 favorite. Wins by unanimous decision. It was a very close fight.
I thought he won, to be fair, but it was a close fight.
He's a minus 400 favorite against Alan Nascimento, won by split decision. I thought Alan Nascimento won. He loses to Tim Elliott. He's a minus 235 favorite. I thought he had a pretty good case that he won that fight. Now, for the man himself, for Tagiro Lambekov, was booked this summer against Tyson Nam, out due to injury, he gets Nate Maness. For Nate Maness, I don't know, when you fight guys in the UFC, like a Kid Kvenbo, Johnny Munoz Jr., yeah. You beat him, close fight, you beat Luke Sanders, it was a huge comeback, he gets a bonus for that one. You beat Tony Gravely, where he got knocked just about dead to rights at the end of the first round. It's a shovel hook, I think he got knocked out by in the first round. He kind of comes to his senses. Second round, he's getting beat, and then all of a sudden, he lands his own knockout blow, ground and pound, finishes Tony Gravely. Then they put him up against, like, Umar Nurmagomedov. Okay. When you sign to fight Nurmagomedov, you know, listen, I mean, Nurmagomedov was a -950 favorite. Then they're like, here, fight his teammate Tagiro Lambekov.
Okay.
You remember when you're growing up in every science class you took in high school or university, you had to take Wimish training?
I did, yeah.
And after you did it the first time, you knew all the answers. You did the same test year after year after year, basically. It was all the same thing, which is to make sure you didn't blow up the whole classroom with chemicals, basically. You know, in that test, there was a part, and it was to do with the triangle of fire. It was oxygen, fuel, and ignition. In the UFC, there's a very similar triangle, and I would call it Damon Jackson, Julian Arosa, and Nate Maness. They all kind of fight in the same way. Like, they're going to be that volume striker who's going to force you to go into uncomfortable takedown attempts, who are really going to take advantage once you do show those negatives in your striking game. And I understand Nate Maness isn't necessarily on the level of those two previous fighters. I do think Arosa and Damon Jackson are, like, borderline top 15 fighters. And maybe in the flyweight division, Nate Maness also is. But Maness shows a lot of those similar characteristics where it's, hey, I'm going to really pressure you, try to force out negative takedown attempts from you. And then once you do that, I'll try to cinch up a neck, an arm, just any limb that is available. Because for Maness, I think there is a world out there where the weight cut does go well for him, where he looks good at the weight class. And if that is the case, like, there's some guys who are in trouble, Craig. Like, he's gonna maul them, take them down, submit them, be so much bigger than them that there's not much of an option. And I do like how you open this video, because it is a good point. Tagiro Ulanbekov normally does enjoy the luxury of being the much bigger fighter in the flyweight division. Now, against Nate Maness, if he is successfully able to make the weight without any huge detriments to the Then Maness could have...
That's not nice. Don't make fun of him.
Sorry, I'm the one who messed up, not him.
He's a comedian.
Go ahead. Maness could have success with his game plan. I think we could both agree there. But the problem is, I don't know how Maness ends up on top in this matchup. And that's the problem I do end up having. I think on the bottom, he could be an active fighter. He could threaten with submissions. But I do think he's going to have a hard time to get any set positions. And for Ulanbekov, I like his wrestling. I like his overall striking from the outside to at least get the clinch. And if those are the situations where the fight is fought under, I do like Ulanbekov to at least be the more controlling fighter between the two.
So I put the picture up there. This is going to be a flyweight, right? Because, listen, we've done videos like this, and then in the 11th hour at the start of fight week, they switch it, and it ends up at bantamweight or a different division. So you have proof. I have proof. So if anything changes, we'll let you know later on in the week. And this is definitely a question mark kicks fight. I'm going to boil it down this way. Ulanbekov -180, Maness +150. Topology vote, surprise to us, they are to you. I'm going to say the fans, 75% over-under to your Ulanbekov. I want to get this going.
I think it'll be over.
It's going to be over. It's under. 557 really? Total votes. 61% Ulanbekov. 86% by decision. 39% Maness. 62% by decision. If this is a bantamweight, Nate Maness beats Tagiro Ulanbekov.
I agree.
Ulanbekov is good with his takedowns. He doesn't do much with it. Once he gets you down, he holds position. His striking, I actually think it got better from the fight that he beat Alan Nascimento to the one that he lost to Tim Elliott. I know he gets dropped in the first round. He had nice 1-2s. He had nice leg kicks. It wasn't leg kick. Reset. A lot of time. I thought Ulanbekov looked good, and I thought his cardio was decent. I thought he beat Tim Elliott. But this to say, Nate Maness is a much better striker. Nate Maness has better power. I talked shovel hook, and I thought it was Gravely. Gravely hit him, dropped him with a right hook in tight. It was Maness that landed that shovel hook that dropped Tony Gravely. Odd angle punches are his specialty. I like his kicks. I like his long range weapons. The volume with the power. I flipped my pen and caught it. You didn't see it.
That
but the point
slick.
Is,
I like Nate Maness in a lot of those areas in MMA, and I think he could win out in this fight. I need to see what the weight cut looks like. I need to see him at 125. With all of those question marks and Ulaanbaatar going minus 500, minus 400, minus 235... at a minus 180, I think there's still a little bit of value there in Ulaanbaatar. But if it was at 35, I'd take Maness. It says it's not, so I have Ulaanbaatar. But guys, I do have a hard time with this because without doing the research and just looking at it, I'm serious, guys. I was like, yeah, Nate Maness wins this fight.
Well, Craig, luckily you bring up question marks. And we have a show called Question Mark Kicks. It starts 2 hours before the first prelim. And it allows us to go back, give a chance to look over any fights that we've ever changed our opinion on because of the weight cut, because of anything that has come out during the week. So I agree with you. I also have Ulaanbaatar. But if anything has changed due to the weight because Maness has had a very extreme weight cut, maybe I will change my opinion by the end of the week. But for right now, I have Ulaanbaatar.
Both of us going with Tagir Ulaanbaatar, training with Usman Nurmagomedov. He's got a title fight coming up. Training with Islam Makhachev. Father's
just
plan. Now champ. So let us know in the comment section. We need your help on this one. Who you have. The next fight. Josh Parisian, Chase Sherman. The next fight. Like, there's Neil Magny taking on Daniel Rodriguez. Marina Rodriguez, Amanda Lemos. Make sure you check out all of those videos. A like is definitely appreciated for the Fight Night Picks team. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
The most 2008 heavyweight fight you could have in 2022 if you watched the fights last weekend and if you like Jared Vandera versus Waldo Cortez Acosta. Coming up on the main card of another fight night, unranked heavyweights Josh Parisian and the Vanilla Gorilla, Chase Sherman.
Is it fair that we say that more than we should, though, that it's a 2008 heavyweight fight, the year 2022?
All right, you know what? You want to make this one fun, Fight Night Picks fans? Scorpion Fighting System versus Killcliff FC. What's the better nickname? Before we did this video, I reached over to the vinyl collection. I thought, I'm going to find something. I'm going to use it as a prop. And then I found exactly what I wanted. If you know how to pick this fight, then it's kind of like Willie Nelson's Stardust. Now, Matt, you're getting to be with a man.
Wow.
Look at the back of that record. What a guy. And he still looks about the same.
Willie Nelson guy, too.
You're going to need some Willie Nelson Stardust with such songs as September Song, Blue Skies, Georgia On My Mind, that's a highlight.
And is that a Blue Skies on it?
Yeah, it does have Blue Skies.
Let's go!
So, again, the record collection over here. You never know what you're going to find in my record collection, Matt. But when it comes to this fight between Chase Sherman and Josh Parisian, I can boil it down this way. Josh Parisian fights like how Jared Vandera should fight, and Chase Sherman fights like a boxer at heavyweight. That's pretty, with good leg kicks, but sometimes he doesn't throw.
Here's the problem, though. Every 3 to 6 months, we come on this channel and tell people how Jared Vandera should fight. So I guess for Josh Parisian's sake, we should break it down. He does offensively wrestle. His striking is somewhat basic, although it is effective. He will box his way into the clinch and then go for a lot of wrestling engagements. But it does feel like Chase Sherman has been in this similar fight many times in his career. We have definitely sat in these chairs before and said, hey, Chase Sherman's a better striker, but X, Y, and Z his opponent brings to the table. And this is no different than the majority of his other fights. But I will say this to Chase Sherman's benefit. And maybe against his last opponent, it doesn't mean the most. But
who was his last opponent?
Jared Vandera. I didn't expect a lot out of Chase Sherman. I just sort of completely written him off. I didn't think he was going to have a lot of success in the UFC against anybody, to be completely fair. He didn't look good his last time out, and that's the thing about Sherman. I will say the one thing, and I think you'll agree with me on this. The one X factor he has, if you will, he does have good output for the heavyweight division. He's a guy who's going to throw a lot of punches. Now, it can be to his own detriment because we do see him slow down after he does throw a lot of punches.
In some fights, yeah.
Exactly, because he's one of these fighters who, in pursuit of offense, does lack some defense. He is hittable in a lot of these matches, but I will say this about Sherman. He is an outlier with his cardio. He does have good hand speed. He does have good leg kicks, too. That's something we saw a lot more early on in his UFC career. We haven't seen as much of it lately, but his last time against Jared Vandera, there were some positive building blocks that he continued to improve on, but that's the thing. I'll mention this. He looked good against Jared Vandera his last time out. If you want to look to two fights ago, he did not look good whatsoever. Now, I understand there is a big difference between a guy like Alexander Romanov, someone who we look at as maybe not the future of the division, but definitely one of the more promising prospects in the heavyweight division. So, okay. For Sherman, it really does feel like every time he's in the UFC octagon, it's always a readjustment because we know what he's good at, we know what he's not good at. We're just trying to figure out what opponents his skill set does and does not work against.
So for Chase Sherman, he beats Jared Vandera. Listen, round one, what it was, maybe Vandera. Round two, Sherman. Round three, Vandera was having a lot of success on the outside. And listen, Chase Sherman had never finished a fight after the second round. Sherman just flips a switch, unloads, moves forward, rocks Vandera, press him up against the cage, finishes him, and just unleashes a crazy, crazy combination. Gets him in there. Performance bonus. First finish in the third round. Only his third finish after two rounds. Rashad Coulter is one of them, and then his fight against Ike Villanueva. Those are the only finishes that he has outside of round two, round three. And if you look at it, look at all the knockout wins that he has. He's got, what, one decision win to his record against Damian Grabowski. So he has so many first-round knockout wins. And for Sherman, time outside of the UFC, time in the UFC, had the three-fight losing streak, Arlovsky, Porter, Collier, cut from the UFC to pursue bare knuckle, reeling him back in to fight Alexander Romanov on incredibly short notice, loses that fight, but beats Vandera's last time out for Parisian. Will he be able to implement the wrestling? How is the striking? Because for Parisian in the UFC, it's been weird. Two times on Contender Series, first time out, look good, but we want you on The Ultimate Fighter. Didn't do all that great, has to build himself back up. Beat Ocho Cinco, Chad Johnson on Contender Series a couple of years ago. Lose to Parker Porter by decision, didn't look great. Parker Porter, did he beat Chase Sherman? Yes. So by the laws of MMA math, well, they both lost to Parker Porter. Beats Rogi Martinez by split decision.
I didn't have a good run.
I went back and watched that fight, and I definitely didn't think Josh Parisian won it. Dontayle Mays finishes him, elbows from crucifix. I mean, Dontayle Mays, he'll toss that cup in your face. And then his last time out, he did fight Alain Badeau. In that one, he gets a performance bonus. But my goodness, Badeau looked good in the first round until he didn't in the second round. And Parisian was able to implement those takedowns. So can Parisian implement the takedowns? Will he wilt under the boxing of Chase Sherman? Those are the questions. The odds are at par. The fan vote is surprised to us as it is to you over
Both guys need the win though, right?
You always need wins, but definitely in this one.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what I mean. Like, they are not the highest level heavyweights you've ever
seen. You know
what
I'm going to do, Matt? Chase Sherman was a gift king.
Can I pick them because the odds are even?
Yeah, sure.
I think Chase Sherman is going to be 60%.
Yeah, I'm going to say over 60%. Oh. What?
Other way around?
Wow.
Sorry.
509 total votes, 60% Parisian, 24% by decision, 69% by knockout. For the 40% that have Sherman, 25% by decision, 71% by knockout. For Chase Sherman in the UFC, 66% takedown defense. Again, can Parisian take it down to the mat? He didn't have a ton of success against Rocky Martinez in all of these facets. Now, that was a while ago, and maybe he's gotten better. He's had a lot of fights. He fights very often from Parisian. And again, wrestle heavy offense. Maybe you can get it done. Pickled eggs causing havoc in my stomach. But
really are.
If you know a sponsor, bring him on board. I think Chase Sherman wins this fight. Much better striker. And I think you're either way, you'll get a finish. So maybe you want to go with an under. But I do like Chase Sherman in this fight. Never thought I'd say that. But I do like Sherman here.
It's hard to pick a guy who's 1-4 in his last five. But I do agree with you. I think Sherman has demonstrated the ability to defend takedowns from a guy who isn't at least Josh Parisian's level. Again, if you're above his level, then you're definitely going to be able to take Chase Sherman down. But I do think his striking at the heavyweight division is unique in his capacity to throw a lot of volume, to land with a lot of volume as well. And I think that's going to be key. So I agree with you. I also like Sherman.
What would you do if this guy sang like a one-on-one of All of Me?
He'd be my favorite fighter of all time, and it wouldn't even be close.
Imagine Willie Nelson fought. Both of us going with the Vanilla Gorilla Chase Sherman to get the win. A couple of big-time fights left on this card. Magny versus Rodriguez. Rodriguez versus Lemos. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. This weekend, Daniel Rodriguez was formerly ranked. He's looking to regain the number. Oh, wait. No, he already has that number. He's looking to advance. He's taking on Neil Magny in a big-time opportunity. And for D-Rod, can you believe it? He's actually older than Neil Magny. And Magny came into the UFC back in 2012. Ultimate Fighter, Karen versus Nelson.
Oh boy, you remember that, Roy Nelson? I mean, just crazy stuff. But for Magny, goes through. He gets decision wins against the likes of Cameron Diffley and Bristol Morundi. They might sound like names that I just made up on the paper, they're real. He gets knocked out by Mike Ricci, so then he has to build himself back up. They kept him around. He fought John Manley in his UFC debut. Neil Magny's 19-8 in the UFC. It feels like he's been around since the dawn of time, right? But if you do consider it, Rodriguez a little bit older, but in Rodriguez's UFC tenure, it's been great so far. I mean, you consider it, he's what, 7-1. He's got that weird, wonky, tricky loss in his 5-on-in. That one to Nicholas Dalby. A lot of people thought D-Rod won that fight. He beats Mike Perry. He beats Preston Parsons. He beats Kevin Lee impressively. But then he has to rehab his hand. He misses a lot of time. He's not originally due Li Jingliang back a little bit ago. He was supposed to be taking on Kevin Holland, but you had the big switch up. Shamaya fights Holland. Diaz fights Ferguson. So Rodriguez fights Li Jingliang, and you think, okay, that's a fight I can rally around. It's going to be a catchweight at 180 pounds. Not a lot of people thought Dana Rodriguez won that fight, and then a lot more people, which is why I set up the video the way I did at the start, thought, well, Rodriguez is going to be ranked after winning this fight, right? Because he's at a catchweight, and he didn't win, did he? But he did get ranked. So for Rodriguez, he gets an opportunity to right the ship. Now, this fight was originally due, a few weeks ago? It was booked last month. Rodriguez out due to an elbow injury, so they remake the fight. Now, that would have been short notice for both of them. Still looming in the short notice realm, but it is a bit of an interesting fight and a bit of an odd one at that.
So last weekend's main event, I said that, hey, this fight, oddly enough, might be more important for Calvin Kattar than it is for Arnold Allen, because Calvin Kattar's had a lot of chances at the guys in the top 15. He's been in other main event opportunities in his career, so we don't know how many more chances he's going to get to fight these top level guys before the UFC just sort of does way with him. And for Neil Magny, he really is in a similar position, because this fight against Dana Rodriguez reminds me of three opponents that Neil Magny has fought in the past. And for Magny, that honestly might be a bit of a disservice, because he has fought so many of the top level guys at 115 pounds, but hopefully you agree with me. Dana Rodriguez reminds me of Lorenz Larkin, Kelvin Gastelum, and Li Jingliang for these reasons. And all of those fighters had very different results against Neil Magny, because if you are a very power-heavy fighter, you're going to be able to get through to Magny, because Magny's one of these guys we point to. Is he good at wrestling? Yeah, he's a good offensive wrestler. He's a good offensive grappler. He's a good offensive striker. He is an extremely well-rounded fighter, but any fighter who is a specialist, who does have some of these outlier skills in any one area, they're going to have success in that spot against a guy like Neil Magny. So I can see a world out there where Daniel Rodriguez uses the jab, can be that long-range striker to really threaten with power, to hurt Neil Magny when he has to. That'll keep Magny off him with the takedown attempts, and really let Rodriguez work at range where he can have success. But I can also easily lay out a game plan where Neil Magny can kind of extinguish some of the explosiveness of Daniel Rodriguez like he did against Li Jingliang. Because remember, he fought Jingliang and Rocco. It's Anthony now, or I guess it's Rocco now, Martinez. Martin. Because he knew he was the more powerful striker at range, so he used the clinch a lot in that fight, and I think he could have similar success against a guy like Daniel Rodriguez, but I also have to admit that since Rodriguez is the more heavy-handed striker, he could easily hit Magny with two or three counter shots to the outside and really change the tide of this fight, because there's no argument, I don't think. Rodriguez is way more likely to get a finish between these two.
I don't know if either guy's going to get a finish in this one. It's going to go to a decision. But when I do look at it for Neil Magny, maybe you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater, which is a statement.
You told me not to use that when I've used that in the past.
I was just about to say, hate to use it, I hate the saying, but I have to say it, because for Magny, second to last fight against Max Griffin, who could fight a three-round fight and then run three marathons. He looked great last weekend against Tim Means, but he's dropped in the first round. That was a tight fight. He kind of rallies back into it round two, round three. His last time out, he takes on Shavkat Rakhmonov, who, could he fight for a title in 2023? Remains to be seen. But Rakhmonov made him he looked really good in that fight. So for Magny, it's a big time prove it spot. And we haven't seen him look like that dominant guy since the Jeff Neal fight, which again, you could draw some parallels. Jeff Neal to Daniel Rodriguez in some of the southpaw aspects in the striking.
That's the weird thing about this matchup though. With Magny, It's not like he's a fighter who always struggles with a certain archetype of fighter and always has success against another type. He's a cardio king. We always know that about Neil Magny. That's always the thing he's going to have an advantage on over the majority of his opponents. Even if they're a better striker, even if they're a better wrestler, they're not going to be as fresh, for the most part, as Neil Magny by the time that fifth round does come around. And that's why it's weird, but I kind of wish this was the main event, because there's a part of me that thinks Daniel Rodriguez could be a good contender in the 170-pound division. Not a top-tier contender, but just a guy who, similar to an Anthony Smith, I always point to on the wall, Calvin Kattar at 145, there's always that one or two fighters in every division who it's, hey, we need a guy to be in a main event. Who could it be? I think Daniel Rodriguez could kind of take the place that Neil Magny once held, because Magny was once that guy who, hey, we need a main event. Michael Chiesa hasn't fought in a while.
What about on a Wednesday morning?
There's nothing going on a Wednesday at 10 a.m. and everyone's locked down due to COVID. Let's let Neil Magny fight Michael Chiesa. You know what I mean, though? Daniel Rodriguez is the exciting type of fighter who I could see being placed in those types of opportunities. I just think with Neil Magny, it's always difficult to judge where his ceiling's going to be in the division. Because at 35 years of age, we have seen him fight a lot of the top guys in the top 15, if not everybody in the top 15, and we have seen him struggle heavily against some of those fighters, but also, to his credit, have a lot of success against them as well.
Daniel Rodriguez, you're not going to believe this. I'm going to throw a number at you. The number one all time, regardless of weight class, regardless of if it's Royce Gracie or Sean O'Malley, number one all time, strikes landed per minute, 7.84.
Really?
Significant strikes landed per minute. And Neil Magny, number one all time in decision wins in the UFC. Out of any of them, he has 13 of them. So if you do look at this, Matt, it is an interesting matchup. You look at the odds, they're basically at par. Some sites, Neil Magny minus 120. Daniel Rodriguez at a minus 105 to a plus 100. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to assume Magny's a favorite, but I feel like Daniel Rodriguez has a fan support. I'm going to say Tapology over under 57.5% Rodriguez.
I think they're going to be over.
They're going to be over? They're over. So 513 total votes, 60% Rodriguez, 80% by decision. For the 40% that have Magny, 90% by decision. So is Magny chop liver off his last two performances, even though he's 1-1? Is Daniel Rodriguez looking great again? He's a contender. His hand's fine. His elbow's great. And he can slap on maybe like a neoprene sleeve and go in there and beat Neil Magny.
Like, if you fell asleep before this fight card started, let's say you texted me and said, Matt, how did the co-main event go? I feel like I could text you back and say Neil Magny won a well-rounded decision, 30-27. You'd believe me if I said that. But you'd also believe me if I said Daniel Rodriguez went out there, landed a right hook to the body and an overhand left and knocked out Neil Magny. That's how competitive
that part would surprise me.
Would it? I feel like he could. We have seen Magny get stopped in the past, especially early on in fights. Again, I bring up the Lorenz Larkin matchup because I do think Larkin and Rodriguez have similar hand techniques. Now, I will say, Larkin was really able to get to Magny with a leg kick, and that did open up some of his boxing techniques. And of course, Daniel Rodriguez is not as dedicated with his own leg kicks, but still, D-Rod does have that kind of power in his hands to where if he won by finish, I would not be surprised whatsoever. I've had a really hard time picking this fight because, again, like I said, Magny is beaten guys like Daniel Rodriguez and looked really good, like in the Li Xing Liang matchup, but he's also really struggled with guys who do have that power advantage over him. So I like Daniel Rodriguez, the slight underdog in this matchup, but that's only hinging on the fact that I think Rodriguez is going to be able to hurt Neil Magny in this fight. I think if Rodriguez can hit him like Max Griffin did, hurt him early on, I think he can put it on him and maybe get him out of there before the fight can keep on going. Whereas if Magny's going to have success, of course he's probably going to win by decision. But again, this is a very close
and
fight.
And win, lose, or draw in Rodriguez's last fight against Li Jingliang, short notice for both guys. They threw it together. It was a catch weight. And then you consider it, I mean, he had been off for a really long time, so that was kind of a bit of a tune-up. Now that he's back in action, maybe he's rolling like he was against Kevin Lee, against Mike Perry. For Neil Magny, I made the comparison to the fight that he had against Jeff Neal. Neal was super low on volume, like low even to his standards in that fight.
Was that his first fight back off injury?
And Magny was able to mix it up with his wrestling in that one, too. I think Magny comes in with a well-rounded skill set, with the wrestling, which we've seen Rodriguez taken down in the past in the UFC. Rodriguez obviously has those tricky things that he can throw at you in the clinch. The knees, the elbows, the uppercuts, and you saw that Tim Means submission that he was able to crank out early on in his tenure. But I think for Neil Magny, the well-roundedness, the skill set, one more win against a guy that's going to give him a bit of a test. I'm going to go with Neil Magny ever so slightly, but it is a really tough one in this one for
and
both guys.
And huge welterweights, too. I cannot stress this enough. Like, Daniel Rodriguez is 6'1" at 170. Normally, he enjoys being the bigger guy in there, but against Neil Magny, who is arguably as big as a welterweight can possibly get, there's, like, prime Douglas Lima, and then there's Neil Magny right next to him. So, I'll be very interested to see how Rodriguez does deal with the bigger guy, because you know he hasn't normally had to be in there with guys who have that height advantage over himself. But I think it's a fun fight.
Both of us were split on the pick. I've got the Haitian sensation, Matt, going with D-Rod, a guy who's added to the tattoo collection since the last time we had seen him. Inside of the octagon, please let us know who you have in this matchup down below in the comments section. It gets spirited, and we need your support. So toss us a like, and if you haven't subscribed already, consider doing so, because there's so many of you that hover over that button and don't actually go for it. In the main event, Marina Rodriguez, Amanda Lemos. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Main event time coming up this weekend at strawweight. We have Marina Rodriguez taking on Amanda Lemos. Brazil versus Brazil for an opportunity at the title. And just a few weeks ago, we had a main event under somewhat similar circumstances at strawweight. Mackenzie Dern taking on Yan Xiaonan. Xiaonan with a very impressive win there. And for Rodriguez, kind of feels like she should have already had a title shot 100%. At this point. She fought Yan Xiaonan her last time out. Very controversial decision win for Rodriguez in that fight. And if she had an impressive win, that probably would have been the opportunity. But now she finds herself in her third main event in the last couple of years against Amanda Lemos. Now, Amanda Lemos had her first main event earlier on this year and laid an egg.
A little underwhelming, yeah.
Laid an egg against the former champ, Jessica Andrade. Got finished, but she followed it up her last time out. Performance bonus submitted, Michelle Watterson Gomez. So, Matt, when it does come down to this matchup, I hate to oversimplify it. I really do this early on into a video. Listen, Rodriguez, we've seen her in five-round fights. Her style is conducive to winning five-round fights. Death by a thousand cut, but good power when she needs to use it. I throw it over to the fight that she had against Amanda Ribas not that long ago. Rodriguez has struggled against the threat of the takedown in some of her fights. One of the draws that she has is against Randa Marcos, the loss to the now champ, Carla Esparza. Those were the issues in those fights. She fought Claudia Gadelha a little while ago as well, a little bit in that one. But if you consider it for Lemos, look at her fight against like Angela Hill. Drops early on, but kind of blew that load a little early and struggled with some of the volume as the fight went on. That was a controversial win for Lemos in the last calendar year, but she is a finisher in this division that we don't see that often. Wins over Montserrat Conejo, Livia Souza, the former Invicta champ in the last couple of years, and then again, the aforementioned Watterson Gomez. So won't come to a surprise to many people when I say if it's going to be a finish, you would assume Lemos, unless exhaustion plays a part, and Rodriguez, death by a thousand cuts, she's able to take over. But when I look at a matchup like this, I do have X factors either way, and I will sway one way more than the other. But you look at it, Matt, and I feel like a lot of people, the odds included, are going to sway towards Rodriguez.
And it does make sense, because we have seen her prove it against a lot more top-level competition. Like, Lemos, if we're being completely honest, did struggle in her fight against Angela Hill, who, not that Angela Hill is a disrespected contender at this stage of her career, but think about it like Sam Cassell at the end of his career, you know? He was really good. But
just
like
holding his balls in the court?
That's true. Fred VanVleet hit the Philadelphia 76ers with a buzzer beater last season in the regular season and did that celebration running down the court to Sam Cassell's their assistant head coach. And that's gangster as fuck. But for Amanda Lemos, we have seen her struggle, like you had mentioned, with some fighters who, again, their apex skills aren't necessarily the same as someone like Marina Rodriguez, but at least physically, they do match up with her in the strawweight division, because there's not a lot of these long-rangey strikers in the division, but the ones who are built in that type are at the top of the division. Like, think about Joanna Jędrzejczyk. I know recently retired, but still was able to run the division for a very long time. Marina Rodriguez, to me, is somewhat the spiritual successor to a Joanna Jędrzejczyk. I know she doesn't have necessarily the Muay Thai background or someone like Joanna, but Rodriguez, good takedown defense, although struggles defensively once the fight does hit the mat with her grappling. I just think for Rodriguez, that's the position that she is trying to fill. We just don't really know if she's going to be able to share a lot of those same defensive skills that Joanna does. Because the thing that you forget about Joanna is, remember how good her takedown defense was back in the day?
Jessica Andrade picked her up over her head, and Joanna still didn't get taken down by it because her balance is that good. Those are the skills that Rodriguez is going to have to work on as she does keep on fighting these top-level competitions, but she's not going to have to worry about that against someone like Amanda Lemos, who is going to go in there, use a lot of the same striking that she is, and is going to fight at a similar range that Rodriguez is. I'm just curious to see, when does Lemos start to slow down? Because on the feet, both these fighters, I would say, have very good power for the division, even though Lemos is more of an outlier, I would say, more of that one-punch hitter-quitter type power, even though for Rodriguez, she's someone who can damage a fighter as the fight progresses, especially in a five-round atmosphere. So I guess for this fight, I think the five rounds are really important. If this is a three-round fight, I think Lemos would have an area where she could win, look really dominant with her own power striking early on, maybe give up the third round, but hey, that happens to a lot of fighters. I just think with this being a five-round fight, it uniquely suits the skill set of someone like Marina Rodriguez.
Well, getting ready for Lemos versus Andrade, I look at Andrade, and Lemos is just kind of a, you know, not a lesser
the
version.
The store brand version.
Yeah, put it that way. Like, you go to, like, TJ Maxx and you'd find Amanda Lemos cereal next to the Pop Rocks.
She's like Kirkland. Like, no name, you're
no,
struggling.
Kirkland stuff's really good.
That's what I mean. Like, Amanda Lemos is Kirkland. It's good. It's borderline brand name. It's not like no name you get from Superstore where you're like, oh, this
Kirkland's
is tough.
Kirkland's sometimes better than brand name. I don't want to talk
about
Big Box Store.
That's my whole point about Amanda Lemos, though.
You don't
Kirkland
have to show.
Is as good of a no-name product as you can be. So for Lemos, yes, she might be somewhat of a store brand version, but she is the highest quality version that you could possibly be for a store brand.
Regardless, I mean, Lemos, when I looked at her in that fight against Andrade, both have good takedowns, both have good power punching.
Huge.
I had that one as close. Andrade gets the win, but for Lemos in this one, I could see her going out there, earning the takedown, getting a quick finish. I could also see Rodriguez taking it into the deeper waters and just continuing her role. We look at our Instagram page. It's at Fight Night Picks. We throw polls out there all the time. 65% of you have Rodriguez to get the win. We threw it out there to you in the YouTube community tab. We look at the YouTube community tab. Refresh it. We will. We have a look at the total votes that are over there. 71% going with Marina Rodriguez, but we always throw it over to your comments. You're not commenting very often. Travis saying Lemos is dangerous, but it's hard to go against Rodriguez here. She's just too well-rounded. Michiganian, Marina wins minutes on the feet. Lemos wins minutes on the ground. Rodriguez will lose a round or two because of this, but we'll be able to keep it standing. Henke, I think Lemos catches her for some reason. And Jay
like
says,
Tom Henke, the great closer for the Jays?
Lemons... weight cut will get her drained during the later rounds. Rodriguez has cardio experience for five rounds. I think Rodriguez has that opportunity. She's a minus 215 favorite. Rodriguez open minus 160. Lemos open plus 130, plus 172 as it is. I think Lemos has a great opportunity here. I think if you like her early, go for that if that's your feeling here. But when I do look at that fight against Angela Hill, that gives me pause. Drops her early, spends a lot of time in top control, round two, round three, didn't have the cardio. I thought Hill won that fight. The fight against Andrade gets finished. The fight years ago against Leslie Smith at bantamweight is really weird.
Yeah.
It's wild, and Smith takes over and gets a win. But for me, I like Rodriguez. I like the volume. The takedown defense gives me a bit of pause, especially early. So I have questions in the back of my mind about taking Lemos, about taking her very early, but I will go with Rodriguez here.
The good thing for Lemos, it's not like she's fighting a wrestler where, okay, on the feet she has a clear advantage, and on the mat she has a clear disadvantage. The majority of this fight is going to be contested in an area that she can have success in. I just think the five rounds is more suited towards Marina Rodriguez's style. I like her output. I like her steadiness as the fight goes on. Maybe Lemos can hurt Rodriguez early on in the fight, and maybe just be steady and kind of match her output as the fight progresses, because if Rodriguez gets hurt by a big shot early on in the fight, it might make her a little bit more tentative as it progresses. So again, there's definitely a world where Lemos could win this one, but I agree. I do like Rodriguez mainly for her steadiness in the 25-minute atmosphere.
Hey, we're back to the intro that we start all of these videos at. We've never done this. Listen, make your picks below. Let us know who you have in all of these matchups. 13 fights announced at the start of the week, but as you know, last week there was only 9 and they were gonna add more. We're at the time of the year where things are moving, they're shape shifting. You want to end 2022 on a high note, make sure you're subscribing to the channel. It certainly helps us out a lot. A like is appreciated. And Matt, a little treat on Saturday. What do we have 2 hours before the prelims?
We've got this great show known as Question Mark Kicks. If you love the technique that Luke Rockhold has borderline perfected, then you should love the show that we have 2 hours before it starts. We give you a little bit of time. Go out, buy your snacks after the show's done, just so you can come back and watch the fights. But again, it's just an opportunity for us to go back, look over any of our final predictions. If there was someone who missed weight, maybe they looked really bad on the scales, even if they did miss, or even if they did make weight, sorry, it gives us the chance to go back and revise some of our picks. But yeah, it's just a great chance to talk to you guys about the fights a little bit more, and that's the best part about this. I don't know a lot of people in my regular life who like MMA. I know people who like basketball. We're Canadians, so I know a lot of people who like hockey. I know people who like football and baseball. Not a lot of people in my day-to-day like MMA, though, but you guys do, so I love keeping the discussion going as the week progresses.
Thanks so much for the support. So much for tuning in. Looking forward to a big week with Fight Night Picks. Keep it locked in, and as we always say,
let's get into it.